And what did happen?
Okay. You see, we did crash. It was on this crazy island. And we waited for rescue, and there wasn't a rescue. And then there was a smoke monster. And then there were other people on the island. We called them the Others. And they started attacking us. And we found some hatches, and there was a button you had to push every 180 minutes, or... Well, I was never really clear on that. But the Others didn't have anything to do with the hatches. That was the Dharma Initiative. They were all dead. The Others killed them. And now they're trying to kill us. And then we teamed up with the Others because some worse people were coming on a freighter. Desmond's girlfriend's father sent them to kill us. So we stole their helicopter and we flew it to their freighter, but it blew up. And we couldn't go back to the island because it disappeared. So then we crashed in the ocean and we floated there for a while until a boat came and picked us up. And by then there were six of us. That part was true.
I came on a plane.
What plane?
A Jira Flight 316. And that's how I returned to the island.
So, why him?
What was it that was so wrong with me? What about me?
What about you?
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 6, Episode 9. It's Ab Eterno Week.
Abs.
Dear host, if some guy in a black shirt tells you to stab a stranger with a Roman knife, do you do it? My name's Dave Gonzalez, and if you've listened to this podcast and know how I love antagonism, yeah, probably.
My name's Joanna Robinson, and my question for you is, does he look like Titus Welliver?
And I'm Neil Miller, and I believe the answer is always going to be yes. It is Titus Welliver on an island of mystery, so my answer is I would absolutely stab a man. But I would follow the instructions.
Yeah, that is important. Don't let him speak at all, and don't let him talk you out of it.
Mm-hmm.
This week, big week for mythology. We're going to have to decide which island god, if either, seems to be making a better pitch for being on his side or their side. Let's not gender these. They're both played by men. They're men. We'll deal with this. I don't know why I got this that deep that fast. Here we go, guys. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or visiting the Cork Island for the first time. Each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. And then there's another section after the calm section. It's called The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers, discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. For the final season of Lost, we've shifted to releasing this podcast on Saturday evening in the U.S. after our group live watch in our Storm Slack. How do you join the live watches? Why, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. There you'll find ways to subscribe to us for a monthly fee, and any of those levels gets you access to our Storm Slack, where we do our Saturday watch-alongs. When you subscribe for the first time, you get instant access also to our previous years of bonus content, which include extra interview bits, bonus podcasts, and various oddities. You might have noticed if you listen to the show a lot, I didn't tell you to look at your time codes, because there's a little spoiler in the time codes and in the title of this episode. This week is a very important week for Lost, so we're returning to an episode with an interview. Joanna, who did you talk to this week?
We got Nestor!
Yay!
Yay! Hell yeah. Ricardo, Ricardus, Richard himself is here. We're so thrilled and delighted to have him here. I was talking to the guys about this final season, and I was like, people don't seem to care that much about the interviews. Like, should we do any interviews for the final season? What do we think? And they're like, yeah, you can skip it if you want, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, but... Nestor. I was like, oh yeah, Nestor. So Nestor's here to talk about his great episode. I'm so thrilled. So we will get to that, obviously, in the middle of smack dab between the calm and the storm. We will talk to Nestor Carbonell. Also, you know, there's other stuff that's going on in the world of the storm averse. Kristen and I are rolling off drag themed feels like the first time bonus episodes into Angelina July. Welcome to Angelina July, where we will be watching Salt, Wanted, and Gone in 60 Seconds, one of which I have never seen, so I'm really excited.
Oh, wow. Which one's the one you've never seen?
Wanted.
It's a mystery. No, I've definitely seen... Are you kidding me? A James McAvoy movie? Of course I've seen Wanted in the theater.
Oh, I'm excited about this one. This is a great selection.
Yeah, I think I did a good job with the picks. They all had to be, you know, Angelina movies that Kristen hadn't seen, and that narrowed down the list a bit. But I think we got some fun action, Angie.
Chris Pratt getting hit in the face so his teeth spell fuck you. It's pretty great.
Welcome to summer. So you can join us in our joint sort of Slack and listen to those episodes if you are a Patreon subscriber. If you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, that's how you can support us there. You can hang out in the Slack. You can watch Lost episodes with us. It is my month for Movie Club. And I'm just going to go ahead and announce the Movie Club right now. It's not even July yet as we're recording this. And I'm going to announce that the July Movie Club that we're going to watch at the end of the month is one of my favorite movies of all time. Finally on HBO Max, we're watching Sneakers. We're following up a Mary McDonald performance with another Mary McDonald performance in Sneakers.
I don't know if I've ever seen Sneakers.
Oh, I'm so excited. It's so good. So there we go. I'll be talking about how great Sneakers is for the rest of the month until we watch it. But Dan Aykroyd, Robert Redford, River Phoenix, Sidney Poitier, the list goes on and on. David Strathair and Ben Kingsley. It's to whom's who of James Earl Jones is also there. So it's just great. Great. We're gonna have a great time. You can go to stormpodcast.com to find out our schedule. You can find us on Twitter at stormpodcast. We got a bunch of reviews, I think, because that's what happens kind of anytime someone says something mean about us. Some people come in and say nice things about us. So
the Avengers finally arrived.
Here's from May of Green Gables from Australia. And Gables is spelled G-A-Y. So happy Pride, May. 5 stars. I don't know what I'm going to do when this podcast ends. Not to be dramatic, but seriously, I don't. Love the host. Love the pod. Love Lost. This is not my first time reviewing, but I heard people were talking smack about my fave, so I'm here to give my completely biased review. This is a show you want if you love Lost or have never seen an episode. Thoughtful, self-aware, hilarious, and nuanced takes from excellent, clever, high-energy humans. You are very good. Never tighten up. Don't fall down. Absolutely welcome to read this podcast in Australian accent. I didn't, but if not, please just ask Dave to say 4 billion beans. Dave?
4 billion beans!
There we go. All right. This one is also an Australian review, and it comes from Skies. I don't know how to pronounce this username. I apologize. 5 stars. Standing Joanna, the boys are an added bonus. While I came for the Thrones chat, I stayed for the Lost rewatch. Who knew that this podcast about antagonist watch lock and dozens button count would be the smooth tones I needed to ground my 2020 and beyond? I look forward to your new episodes popping into my feed, and I'm sad Lost is quickly coming to an end. But what's next, guys? Never tighten up. I think Joanna should always talk more, and those who shout otherwise should be banished to Hydra Island. That's right, to the bear cages with you. All right, so thank you for that. We are
The good news for these folks who seem very concerned about what happens after Lost is that the podcast is continuing.
We just have too many ideas, honestly.
Right. We just haven't quite nailed exactly what it's going to continue talking about, but you'll still be able to listen to all three of us every week, I would assume.
Probably. And then this last review, 5 stars, comes from Bear Down 623, a Chicago couple that loves this podcast. No need to try to read a Chicago accent. Just extend some A's and say tree instead of three.
Chicago.
These tree hosts. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. My wife and I found this podcast in the beginning of the pandemic while listening to Joanna and Dave Chen's podcast, Decoding Westworld. We've both been to the island 2 or 3 times. But never rewatch Lost one episode at a time, week by week. Since the end is just a few episodes away, we want to express how great this podcast is and how meaningful it's been during an awful 1.5 years. Storm Podcast is great not only because they're incredibly knowledgeable Lost fans, but Dave, Neil, and Joanna are all huge TV nerds and do an amazing job of explaining how TV shows work, and how they're written, which in turn cements Lost as one of the greatest television shows ever, as many reviews have already stated. The Storm Pod is a wonderful constant in our lives, and we're so grateful we found it. Thanks you all, Jonathan and Meg. So, thank you guys so much for those lovely reviews.
Yeah, was his name a Bear Down for Midterms reference?
I don't know what that means.
You know, you gotta really focus. You gotta bear down for midterms. It's Community? No?
Maybe.
All right. Bear down for midterms.
If that was a Bear Down for Midterms joke, please email us and let us know. Okay, and then we got one more email that was sort of also a review that I wanted to read. This is from Anna from Argentina. And she writes, "Hey, you guys, so excited to be writing to you. My name is Anna, and I'm from Tucumán, a small city in Argentina. First of all, sorry if I misspell some words. English is my second language. I hope you understand me." I mean, this is beautifully spelled. She has nothing to worry about. "I really love the podcast. I found it by chance some time ago when I saw a tweet about the Jungle of Kistery, and I was like, what is that? I was very intrigued because Lost is one of my favorite shows, so I went to check the account of the pod and saw that Neil was one of the hosts, and since I really like At One Perfect Shot, I decided to listen to a few episodes. I have to be honest, at first I did not like it that much. I thought it was too long, and also Joe talks so fast sometimes that it was hard for me to keep up. Again, English is my second language. But I kept listening, and I'm so glad that I did because I really enjoy the pod. Currently, I am not watching the show, but I still listen to the podcast. I'm still in season 5. I don't have that much free time to listen, and I have to say I love the long episodes. It actually works great for me because I listen in parts whenever I can. Anyway, I just want to write before the pod ends and tell you that you're very fine humans and keep up the good work. Yes, Joe is my favorite person on the pod. I love her comments. She can read this email in any accent she wants. You have my approval, Joe. PS2, do not fall down. So thank you so much, Anna. Wow. I didn't do any accents. No international incidents were caused today by my accent work, but thank you guys all so much for the reviews and the emails. Warms our hearts. And last but not least, I just want to say that Dave will be leading our live watch of our next episode, which is The Package, which is a hotly anticipated episode as well, I think. So there you go. So that's all my stuff, I think. So that leaves me to ask Neil.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Neil, what happened in Averno?
Our minds were blown, I'm assuming, that everyone listening to this who just watched along with us had a good time. With Ab Eterno, which is an episode that was written by Melinda Sue Taylor, Gregory Nations, and directed by Tucker Gates. It aired on March 23rd, 2010, and it takes place on days 8 and 9 following the arrival of Ajira Flight 316 on the island. In a flashback, we begin by watching as Jacob visits a very, very badly injured Ilana in a hospital and tasks her with going to the island to protect the candidates. Ooh. In even further flashbacks, we learn about how Richard Alpert was once just a simple 19th century farmer living in the Canary Islands. After accidentally murdering a doctor and losing his wife to an unidentified sickness, Ricardo only narrowly escapes a hanging by being sold into servitude to a man named Magnus Hanso. On the way to the New World, the ship that's transporting him, called the Black Rock, is caught up in a storm and brought to the Island of Mystery. After his enslavers meet a grisly end at the hands of old Clickety-Clack, Richard is left to suffer and hallucinate about his dead wife until he's finally rescued by a very handsome man in black. After this man in black convinces him to go kill Jacob, who he claims is the devil, Richard fails spectacularly, but ultimately learns of the island's true purpose and accepts a job as Jacob's representative to the candidates being brought to the island. We also learn that the island itself is a cork, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a few minutes.
Cork, 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 cork.
Back in present time, a hopeless, forlorn Richard considers siding with the men in black, but is talked off the ledge by his wife's ghost and very important assist from Hurley, who can talk to his wife's ghost. She lovingly sets him on a new mission. Stop the men in black from leaving the island, otherwise everyone goes to hell. It all ends, actually, back in that further back flashback with Jacob and the man in black sitting on a log, talking some shit, and ultimately wasting what I assume is good wine. If you're an island god, you gotta have some good wine. My fun fact about this this episode is about the title, Ab Eterno, which in Latin means from eternity. It is also has been used over the many eons to mean since the beginning or for long ages. That, of course, referring to the fact that Richard cannot die. And that leads me to my calm question this week, which is, if given the opportunity by a mysterious island god, would you want to live forever? And I will start by saying, yes, this is one of the things I've always wanted. I want to see what happens at the end of Earth. But I'm curious to, like, from a scientific standpoint, I just want to see what happens. But I'm curious. Let's start with Dave this week. What do you think?
There's two battling sides to me. There is one side of me that's like, you know that part of you that, like, sometimes wishes he could fall asleep for months and just wake up and all this shit was done? Imagine never even having that option. Like, that is what an endless life means to me. Like, it'll never be over. Whatever you're in has the potential to go on forever. The other side for me is a Anne Rice Vampire Lestat side, where I'm just like, yeah, I could always be, like, the coolest person, you know, in that time period, and, like, have a rock star phase for, like, 30 years, and then just, you know, kind of continue on my merry little immortal way. I think there could be a lot of fun in living forever if you embrace the mischievous side of it.
Interesting. Joanna, where do you fall on this?
Rather than, like, brooding like Louis?
Not the Louis side. I want to make a daughter, and it seems weird.
I've heard the Queen song "Who Wants to Live Forever," used beautifully in the epilogue of Rick and Morty this week. By the way, enough times that I think I guess I would want to live forever. Maybe I would want the option to live forever, but also, like, vampire rules. Like, if I decide to walk into the sun one day, I die. Like, I want the ability to be like, okay, enough now. Do you know what I mean?
That was a good run. A good run.
I've grown weary of this world. Everyone I know is dead. Enough now.
See, I think I'd take it even with more strict terms. Like, you can't, like, what appears to be the situation here with Richard, which is just nothing is going to kill this guy. I think I would still do it.
Do you still want to see the end of time if then that means you are the only thing left at the end of time?
Sure. Why not?
You want to see Christianity again?
Yeah, that's a good way to pivot into our calm to session topics. Breaking off of Rick and Morty's post-credit scene, Christianity again? After Cowboys? We're here in an episode that doesn't really surprise me that is Joanna's favorite episode, or one of her favorite episodes of season 6. I don't want to put that on you unless you say it.
It's my favorite episode of season
6. Okay, and Joanna's favorite episode of season 6, because not only is it a, you know, Nestor Carbonell, no flash sideways, all flashback.
Barely any island stuff. Like, modern island stuff.
Yeah.
Like, barely any Flight 815ers.
Yeah, it's like literally the Job stuff that Lost has been doing over and over again. We finally get to see Richard as Job, as the tug of war between these two gods. I want to start in the past, in the flashback. I say let's take this chronologically with Richard as much as possible, because it's not that I don't like the bookends. I like the bookends a lot. I just think that the Richard story is more interesting if he doesn't storm off at the beginning, just in terms of how we talk about it. So we have a very preacher-like dilemma at the beginning, where there's a sick wife and there's some travel needed from Ricardo, who's not Ricardus, but we'll get there. He goes to get some medication from a not so friendly doctor, commits some light murder, manslaughter at best, let's say, and then gets caged up, and is given this talisman of Isabella, his wife's cross, after she dies, which he manages to keep a hold of. That's going to keep us as, like, sort of the anchor to whether or not he's pining for his wife. I think at some point he gets rid of the cross and decides to live this new lifestyle. But then at the end of the episode, he has to re-bring it up. Joanna, does the binding of the romantic relationship with Christian imagery work for you, or is a smidge too much?
No, hell, I don't consider it too much. I mean, like, I think what's interesting about Richard's faith is, you know, this is a show that has a lot to do with, like, you know, faith and questions about the bigger things in the universe and the things controlling our actions and free will and all that sort of stuff. And so Richard's, like, not only does it make sense for, like, where and when he lived for him to be this devout Christian, is he Catholic? I don't know. I would assume. But that it ties into this whole, like, amenable to coercion thing that we were used to seeing with John, which is, like, you know, the reason that Richard is able to be played back and forth in this game so easily is, like, because he absolutely believes in hell and devils and gods and fears hell, you know, like the oh my god, Nestor's so good in this episode, but the scene where earlier on when he's in prison and he asks the priest to absolve him and he won't, and his, like, bewildered panic like helps you understand a lot of what happens once he gets to the island as well. And something I thought was really interesting that I read in a recap, and I forget who, I think it was James Poniewozik's Time recap of this episode, is he was like, you know, a character like Hurley has the context of, like, comic books to help process what happens when it comes to this island, you know, and even the like least cultured person on the flight A-15 probably saw at least, like, Jurassic Park or something. Do you know what I mean? But like, but like Richard's context, Richard's comic book is the Bible, so he's like, yep,
it was one of demons. Like, three books they had at the time.
Sure is demons. So I think all of that aspect of his faith is so important above and beyond the, like, you know, the way in which faith is such an interesting part of this whole story. So tying that into Isabella, who works as a sort of angel figure here, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it works. It absolutely works for me, even as a, you know, heathen that I may be. it works for me. Yeah.
I guess the one reason I would say I'd keep it, even though I think there isn't necessarily a great reason to tie Isabella into the Christian symbolism, is otherwise it kind of feels like it's, he went to jail and the one thing they had was an English Bible, you know? It doesn't feel like a long-term commitment thing, which you're right in it, because of everything you said about the island, about it being his comic book. That's the frame of reference that we're supposed to have. I also think it's incredibly interesting. Neil, we've seen some people say they're in hell before. Specifically, we've seen one person say they're in hell before, which is Anthony Cooper. And Anthony Cooper said that the island was hell. Do you remember where he said it?
He was on the ship. He was on an old wooden ship.
He was.
Called the Black Rock in the middle of a jungle.
Black Rock. Is like, I like this idea that the Black Rock itself has now become almost a dark place. Like, we don't have fun when we go to the Black Rock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a place where we go to just let the cynicism out. Just let the darkness out.
Yeah. We're going to have clearly, a Russian roulette with dynamite. We're going to strangle somebody's father, or, you know, slavery and Man in Black stuff.
Yeah, and it's real, you know, it's in the smoke monster's territory, so I guess it's on brand that the Black Rock would be a, you know, pretty dark place.
That is correct, and I think it was Arts, too, when they walked across it, had actually suggested that maybe there was a gigantic wave that pushed it ashore, and we get to see that. So
a really strategically perfectly gigantic wave to throw the ship exactly at the statue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just impressed with I'm impressed with the aim of the storm.
Well, it's a Jacob created storm, right?
Yeah,
that's the implication that he made.
Which is also
storm.
Weird. Did he want to destroy the statue? Like, was that the goal there? he's like, I need to do some remodeling. The next people that we bring, we're going to hit the top of the stupid statue.
Well, and assuming Jacob applies to some sort of near-human rules, if he lived in the statue and there's a wave big enough to take a full-ass ship and slam it into the head of the statue, was he drowning? Did he create, like, a avatar air bubble around himself? Was like this, because in order to get deep enough into the, you know, the other's territory with the BlackRock, that's a huge wave.
Or was he just in there weaving the whole time?
Just weaving. Shut the door and weave through the storm. Fair enough. So we have Richard sold into slavery because he could speak English. Joanna.
Mm. Yeah.
Richard speaks Spanish.
Yeah.
He's hired by a captain named Magnus Hanso.
Yeah.
And sails on the Black Rock, who is homed in Portsmouth. Which one of these things works the least for you?
None of it. What works? What doesn't work for you?
The geography of it?
I feel like the geography or just the throwing in, having to throw in the Hanso. So we've heard of Hanso from season 2 lore. Mm-hmm. Specifically.
From Miles' dad on the
Miles'
tapes.
Dad.
But also yeah, at the auction, at the Black Rock portrait auction, wasn't that also from like the Hanso
It was.
Collection?
And yeah. The only time that we know that he went down with the Black Rock is on the Blacklight map in the hatch. It's listed as Black Rock / Hattori Hanso resting place. No, Hattori Hanso is the one who makes the swords. Magnus Hanso, resting place.
Wait, so what about the geography doesn't make sense to you, Neil?
Well, if he's in Spain, or where are the Canary
No, he's on the Canary Islands.
Oh,
he's
right.
In Tenerife. Okay. And like having spent a significant amount of time on the East Coast learning about pilgrims in Plymouth and stuff like that, they all always stopped it. Seems like a lot of them stopped at the Canary Islands on their
way. Wait, that's still... Okay, so the Canary Islands, though, are off the western coast of Africa.
Yes, correct.
And so you would think that this ship would take a direct line.
I don't think that's again, how guess, like the shipping channels worked or whatever. Like, well, I think you go down to the Canary Islands,
I guess,
and then you go across.
The other potential explanation is that the island was in a different place. Like, it wasn't necessarily in the South Pacific at that time.
Right.
Right.
Because we know the island. You meant the geography with our island. I see what you mean.
Yeah, like, how did they hit an island in the South Pacific if they could have just gone
straight across the North
Atlantic? Yeah, I think
it must have been the Atlantic at that point. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right, that makes more sense, I guess. Makes me feel better.
Yeah, it all works for me. The Hanso stuff is, like... So, it's just a tiny little harmless Easter egg that I think is thrown in there. It doesn't really matter. And
yeah.
It's okay.
I mean, but it doesn't even really matter to the point that I'm like, oh, you guys are doing so good. But then, like, obviously this weird-ass name pops up, and then, like, Captain Hanso's dead. I'm like, okay, then why? I get it, but...
I think what's more distracting in this episode is, like... any of the Ilana stuff. Like, I almost wish we didn't have Ilana or the Lost or the A15ers at all in this episode. Do you know what I mean?
We're going to get there.
Okay.
I think one of the things, though, that you have to give them some credit for is that, you know, the Black Rock has been there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a long time to sit and think about, like, how do we explain how this ship ended up in the jungle? And I can't imagine that they knew that this is what they were going to do with it, you know, back in, what, season 1 when we first discovered the Black Rock?
No.
But it is really impressive that they came to such a, what I think is a very intensely, like, clever way to do it and a way to weave in this very, very mysterious side character who, I guess we finally know the org chart this week. He's just an independent contractor who works for Jacob. He's the PR director.
1099er.
He's Jacob's PR director, and everyone else is just humans. Like, they're not allowed to talk to Jacob. So I guess
like,
that makes
he's
sense.
He's like, you know this looks bad, right? Like, everything you do literally makes you seem like an asshole. So maybe there's a better way. I completely agree. Like, that's why this episode is so good emotionally. Obviously, like, it's an emotional episode, and it slides right in with stuff like LaFleur and The Constant for episodes that really get to me, right? The, like, Richard Isabella storyline, which only has this episode to get us invested in, which is wild. And a lot of that is right at the feet of Nestor. But, like, when we talk about Lost satisfactorily answering mysteries in the final season, if the finale had done what this does, which is weave answers, I was describing it earlier as like you've got a section of the puzzle over here and a section of the puzzle over here, and you're unsure what's going on, and then you find the perfect piece, and that piece not only fits beautifully, it links these two sections of the puzzle that you didn't even know like were linked, right? And it just sort of slides in there. And so you've got, yeah, as Neil was saying, you've got like the answer about Richard and the answer about the Black Rock all wrapped up in an emotional character-driven story that fits in the span of an hour, plus some like cork
Well, I mean,
you know what I mean? Like,
and honestly, I forgot that it happens in this episode, that we are sort of given an explanation, at least from as far as we can trust Jacob, we're given an explanation for like what the island is and like what the whole point of the island is, which is like we have to keep this evil here so that it doesn't go elsewhere and make the rest of the world or destroy the rest of the world or whatever that evil is going to do out there. It feels like there's some real weight to it, and I like that.
There was a point when they were writing this episode that Jacob sort of demurred with the wine metaphor, and they decided to go back and put it back in because they realized they were writing the final season. And they're like, actually, this is where the answers belong, is right here. So let's finally tell them. I'm trying to work chronologically, but we're here at the cork.
Cork.
So
we've been waiting so long to talk about the cork.
Yeah, we've been waiting so long for the cork. So there's the island is a stopper protecting hell, malevolence, evil, bad things represented by the wine from coming out. It's a barrier. It's holding something back. I don't necessarily...
It's like hell's plug.
Yes, it's like hell's plug. And I like that idea now that we now have an idea of what Jacob was protecting. Because the man in black definitely told Sawyer, like, you know, they got to protect the island. And he's like, why or from what? And he's like, it's nothing. It's dumb. It's nothing.
It's just literal evil and hell.
The island needs to be protected, otherwise all hell gets unleashed. Again, I don't know if we factually know more about what the island is, but we now have an emotional context for what we're fighting. We're literally on the front lines of good versus evil. This is not a science fiction experimentation island like we thought it was, at least in the way that Jacob presents it to who wouldn't know what science fiction was in the first place.
But it's kind of both, right? Because, like, what are the Dharma experiments if not the Jacob experiments persisting?
Sure. Well, and also, whatever it is about the island that is happening between Jacob and the man in black has created, like, geological realities that the Dharma, that draws the science people to it. That Dharma was like, you know, we need to explore. There are things happening on this island that we can't explain, so we're going to do these experiments to figure it out. It's just... Dharma was also not allowed to talk to Jacob. Only Richard is allowed to talk to Jacob. So they never quite got the full explanation.
So I guess my other questions when we're in this whole thing is Jacob says he's bringing people to the island because he wants them to help themselves. He's like testing them. And everybody that he's brought so far, he says they're all dead. And then, at the end of the episode...
This just reminds me of, like, at one point in Doctor Who, because, like, all the Doctor Who, like, a lot of the Doctor Who companions, like, die because, like, that's how you you know, that's how you get the fresh young new girl to join the show. And at one point I on the show, like, they're like, hey, maybe stop picking up mortals from Earth because they keep dying on your adventures, Doctor Who. He's not called Doctor Who, the Doctor. And he's like, oh, what? Oh, hmm.
Yes, maybe, oh, fancy, timey-wimey.
Maybe I shouldn't do that. And I feel like it was the same one with Richard being like, and where are all those people now, Jacob? Oh, dead? Hmm. What the fuck are you doing, man?
Cool. I hope we don't continue to do that for another couple hundred years.
With my help.
But it seems like in the end scene, we get this reiteration that the man in black is looking to kill Jacob. And they state that a lot. Is the birth of Richard into his eternal life also the point that Jacob comes up with the idea of a candidate? Because if he's just bringing people there at first to, like, test them and test their mettle, it sounds like this could have been the first actual attempt on his life.
Like, you think this is the point where he started to get organized and write shit down? Well, instead, he's like, of just winging it?
Eventually, given a longer period of time, which in this case is eternity, apparently, the man in black is going to figure out how to kill me. So I need to have a backup. Because that's, you know, I can't let the court come loose and doom everybody.
Okay, that seems plausible. Like, that explains why he now needs an assistant.
Well, and it's what's interesting about the end of this episode is that, like, you know, we have only Jacob's word for this and only the man in black's word for this. And, like, you know, it's hard to figure out which one. I mean, obviously there's coding for which one we're supposed to trust because one of them has a white shirt, one of them has a black shirt. But, like, you know, I am distrustful of Jacob, given everything that he does and that we see him do. But when we have unimpeachable sources, like Isabella translated through Hurley, that the man in black's going to send everyone to hell if he gets off the island. Like, that's news we can believe in, right? Like, that's a source we believe. Mm-hmm. We've heard the man in black say what's going on. We've heard Jacob say what's going on. But now that I've heard it from Isabella via Hurley, like, I'm like, all right, that I believe. I believe her. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
I've only known her for 47 minutes, but goddamn.
She seems very reliable, except for that she was the man in black. But other than that...
She definitely seems to have died. And then, so that's an important life experience, death experience for her. So yeah, I feel like she has access to better information in the afterlife.
I'm glad we're back to Richard, because we left him in our little recap... horribly stranded in chains on the Black Rock, and poor Nestor has to spend, I don't know how many days they shoot each episode of Lost. Say like 2 days. 2 days just chained, doing chain stuff. Gets his fresh water best he can. Really an ingenious idea to pull out a nail and start scraping away at the wood to pull his chains away. But like a real breaking down of defenses and beliefs the entire time. He is convinced he is in hell, and it is like a hellish task. You're chained to a boat that you could never escape from.
It's a bit of a little horror movie inside season 6 of Lost, where we have them create this by putting him inside the ship and never sort of letting him out. You create this situation where everything that happens is terrifying, right? Mm-hmm. Everything that happens to Richard, it would just scare the shit out of you. And I think what's impressive about it is that it's scary even though we, the audience, kind of know what's happening. Like, we don't really know what the smoke monster is doing, but we know what that is. But it's sort of a really, like, thrilling, intense sequence, especially the one where Smokey shows up and murders all the Hanso guys. But I think it's great. And what seals it is two things. One, Nestor gives an amazing performance. And two, he really pulls off the look which I think is very important. Like the bearded, dirty.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
it's
just still working, despite the fact that this man is clearly losing his mind.
And it's a good costume, too. They put him in, like, the, like, high-waisted trousers and the suspenders and the shirt and all this stuff. Like, it's pretty simple. And as it, like, degrades, it just all, like, looks great. They did a great job with his flashback look. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, the little horror movie that happens in the hold of the ship, like, one of the recaps I read cited Gerald's Game, the Stephen King story. I know that Dave or Neil, I don't know who put it in the notes, but someone wants to talk about another Stephen King story. But this, you know, Carlton and Damon are definitely Stephen King fans. And so, like, Gerald's Game, for those who neither read it nor saw the great Netflix Carla Gugino version of it, is about, like, a woman who's chained to a bed for the whole story and all the shit that happens while she's handcuffed to this bed. And it's great. Great little thriller, and there's a great little mini version of it here, and it's just like it all works, and it's all good writing, but like what takes it over the top is just Nestor like going like at 11 the whole time, his fear, his despair, his sorrow, like all of that, he's just like bringing everything. It's so good.
It feels like somebody watched the early season where he was running around the jungle with his shocked face and was like, oh my god, Richard has depth? We've just been having him walk out of the jungle with a torch for like six seasons. We gotta get in there. But yeah, I really love that sequence, just for it takes its time to build that hellish atmosphere and, you know, bring Richard down. It was me who put the other Stephen King in. I was going to reference Randall Flagg rescuing Lloyd in The Stand. Lloyd is a character that gets arrested and gets left in a prison, does not die from Captain Trips, and so has to go and probably started eating his cellmate out of desperation before Flagg frees him. But specifically, Flagg offers him the same deal that the Man in Black offers Richard here, which is just basically, I let you out of the chains, you're going to do whatever I say, right? And when someone's starved for days or weeks or however long on an island of mystery, yeah, they're going to say yes.
Yeah, it's like the first person who shows up and gives me some water, I'm on their team.
Exactly. And then he's got to bounce between teams for a little bit because, yeah, the dude saved him. But the Man in Black, Titus Welliver doing a pretty good in between Titus Welliver and Terry O'Quinn, I think.
Yeah.
For his convincing speech, where he both admits to being the Black Smoke, but it wasn't the Black Smoke who stole Isabella. It was the devil Jacob. You need to stab him with this knife before he talks, because if he speaks, it'll already be too late. What do you think about that, Joanna?
I think it's good to see out of those chains. Titus Welliver, also fantastic in this. And, like, I'm not mad about John Locke being the Man in Black, as some people are or whatever, but, like, I really love when Titus Welliver shows up to play him, because he's so good. And we'll get at least one more that's fantastic Titus Welliver work. So this is great casting. Like, Mark Pellegrino's good and fine as Jacob, but I think Titus Welliver is like as the devil that you kind of relate to. The relatable devil.
Wants to leave.
Yeah, just let him
leave.
How
bad could that be? He just wants to go on vacation. If you were trapped on the same island for hundreds, potentially thousands of years, we don't know. You would also want to leave at some point. Jacob gets to leave. How's that fair?
He presents a new and better argument this time, which is like Jacob robbed him of his body and robbed him of his humanity. We don't know what that is, but that's the most compelling thing that I've heard. And in terms of the Jacob I've seen, yeah, I could see him doing that to somebody.
Yeah, we've seen Jacob pull a few dick moves in our time.
And this Jacob, I think, is the Jacob that Ricardo meets on the beach is like kind of a more dickish Jacob, I think. Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of years before he got punched in the throat in that very beach, Ricardo got beat down and forcibly baptized.
Well, I think he's, like, it's supposed to be like an Old Testament sort of Jacob, right? Like, isn't that kind of the vibes they're giving us? I don't know. Old
yeah.
Testament God is much, as you know.
He's clearly, like, frustrated and rageful about this whole... I mean, do you think... My impression from this is that this is the first time, kind of like Dave said, this is the first time that the Man in Black has taken, like, a direct shot at Jacob, right? That's what causes him to, like, you know, enlist Richard and start working on lists of candidates. So you can sense sort of a frustration there, because now he feels like he's under some sort of direct attack. I don't... It's hard to know what they were doing before then, I guess... sitting around playing with black and white rocks.
So you have the white rock. A white rock makes its appearance in this episode. Mm-hmm. Here's something for your scale sort of move from Jacob. I got this one. Dibs. But... Oh, and something we should say, I mean, it's maybe so obvious that it's maybe not worth mentioning, but for folks who are watching for the first time, like, this is such a... Richard's conviction that he's in hell, that they're dead and they're in hell on the island, is a nice little nod to that being the first most prevalent theory of loss, that the island is some sort of purgatory and they're all dead there, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, and light spoilers, there's still some people who think that.
It's true.
Listen, man, as someone who went through at least 4 seasons of needing to see Lady Stoneheart on Game of Thrones, and never getting it is hard to give up a good theory. And this, you know, the whole, they, you know, this is purgatory, they were dead the whole time, this is hell. It's not a terrible lost theory.
I'm convinced that's why they skip over, from my understanding, if Ricardo accidentally killed a person, asked for absolution, the priest doesn't give it to him, he doesn't go straight to hell, he goes to purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not mentioned, I think, because they already are going to lean into it with Richard saying, like, this is hell, and then, like, sort of deal with it. And then Jacob saying, like, no, this is all really happening. They just didn't want to feed the purgatory fire anymore than they were going to begin with. Plus, as we pointed out, it's just devastating to Ricardo, and that's the character purpose of it. So, like, I'm starting to, this season's starting to make me lean into, like, just give me the good character stuff. Your answers, I feel like, are not as satisfying as you think they are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and as we've been talking about, that's what makes this episode great, is that we get fun, creative answers and good character stuff.
It's pretty good.
I'm just going to mark my calendar. Today is the day that Dave just said, fuck it, give me the good character stuff. Yes! Another white rock for my scale!
Yeah, well, we're gonna get to more Cork discussion, I'm sure, as this podcast continues on. because the metaphysical stuff sort of takes on a slightly religious air here, which is, you know, a very religious air here, which is vagary that inspires belief, which is not very me, but characters and actors, very good. So I'm gonna, just give me the character stuff in this particular episode. It is, I think, Lost's longest not two-parter episode, so at least they got that one right. It's like, yeah, almost 50 minutes, I think.
48 minutes, yeah.
Damn.
That's, about 5-6 minutes longer than most episodes.
All right. Do we have anything we want to say about Richard specifically before we talk about the rest of this episode, which is the bookends that are maybe not as successful?
Well, I mean, something that one of our listeners wrote in the Slack, I think she goes by Pop Culture Preacher, but, like, she was like, is everyone a Job? And kind of, right? Like, when we get this episode, like, if you don't know it in Job, biblical Job terms, maybe you know it in Trading Places terms, but, like, you know, is everyone who's come to the island, you know, a Job? And the answer kind of is yes. Like, Richard's the most obvious Job here. But yeah, it really makes Jacob look very bad. Like, the god who trans innocent people and they all die, or the god who kills them once they get there? Like, the Man in Black wouldn't bring people to the island, it seems like, to prove his point. So I don't know.
He wants to go where the people are.
He wants to leave. He wants to see them screaming.
Right.
Bring hell on earth. It's fine.
He's the god that will come to your house and kill you instead of making you stranded on an island in the middle of the ocean.
Exactly.
He's like the DoorDash of vengeful gods.
But yeah, like, do you think there are too many Jobs? Or can we just consider it one big Jobian game? And then also, like, some people at the time were like, oh, another epic time-spanning romance, thanks Lost. And I'm like, I don't know, I have a bottomless appetite for this, like, give it all to me. Richard makes Desmond look like a chump. Like, Desmond waited 8 years, Richard waited 150 to talk to his ghost wife. Like, you know, it really works. Once again, I think because of Nestor. But I don't know, what do you guys think?
No, I think it does. It's hard to dislike this episode, right? Because it's giving you, even if it's not giving you as much as you want, it's giving you stuff that you're just enjoying. It's like, even with the bookends, they're almost so slight that I can't dislike them too much. Obviously, if you're going to, like, trim something out of the episode, like, why are we flashing back to Alana in bandages if you're not going to, like, address that? But everything else, it's like, you want answers for the island? Fine, here they are. You want answers to Richard? Boom, touched by Jacob. Like, it is presenting answers. Because those answers are confusing, I think it has a lot to do, Joanna, with the way you were talking, where it's like, this is set so far in the past that Richard only has this gamut of questions he could ask to define his world. And he's not going to ask, can Walt be in the computer? Because all those things are, like, nonsense to him. That's our job. So I think this episode does a good job of presenting answers within a context that allows the series to continue moving. Are they going to be successful if they want to break off and try to do this again? Probably not, because it's so performance dependent. Like, I agree with people who are like, oh, another, you know, like, time romance, because the reason we like it is because Lost does that really well. And it has actors that do it really well, and they could show in this episode, they really only need an hour to build that story at this point, and build it well. If you do that story on another show and don't execute it well, then yeah, it's bad. I think that's like all television ideas. No one, like, it's such a high level of execution in season 6, and so close to the temple, I'm really feeling like... they have the time travel season control over this episode, and I'm hoping they could keep it going forward, because it, like, this one feels like a restatement of purpose. If all of the splitting off from the temple, the weighing whether or not Saeed was bad, the, you know, who is this person walking around in John Locke's skin, we're all feeding other mysteries and maybe successfully moving character. This one is our first solid answer episode, I think. Even though, you know, it does make our good god look like an asshole. I think that might be just the truth.
Yeah, well, I do think mm-hmm. it's intentional. But, like, and it's why watching it again this morning, I was like, I'm so excited, because, like, not only am I going to love this episode, but I think Dave's going to like it too, because there's a lot of mystery answer stuff in it too. Like, we don't have to fight. It gave us everything. And then Neil will just be as perfectly amenable as he often is, you know what I mean? It's just like, there's something for all of us. But to your point in terms about execution, I wanted to ask Neil about this. Like, the writers of this episode are Melinda Sue Taylor, as you said, and Gregory Nations, and then the director is Tucker Gates. And these are not, like, Lost rock star names, mm-hmm. right? None of them. And we talked about this, I think, with LaFleur as well. Tucker Gates, I was looking at his CV, and he's just, like, a reliable TV director guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's all he's ever done, is, like, reliable, you know, and I was looking through his CV, and then I'm like, yeah, I remember that episode of Parks and Recreation, or I remember that episode of, like, this, but none of them are, like, all-time bangers. And so, it's just, like, you know, we
it makes it, it makes, yeah. You know, and this is not a disrespect to them in any way, but it makes it feel almost slightly more magical as a feat of television.
Yeah.
That it's like, all right, well, this is an episode that it may have not have been, you know, a super high priority in the room, because those are the episodes that, you know, usually get Damon and Carl, right? Or those are the episodes that are directed by Stephen Williams or Jack Bender. So this would have been, you know, just sort of, all right, this one's in the middle. Go to town, see if you can figure out how to answer some questions, and we just need some background on Richard. And, you know, they not only deliver sort of the high level quality of like figuring out how to frame Richard's story, but all of the little character moments work extremely well. And the way it's shot creates, you know, excellent mood. I mean, there's only so much you can do when you're shooting TV on and you're trying to make it look consistent with the rest of the show. But I do think that they take some clever roads to delivering this story, and it makes it feel like it really jumps out as like, oh, this is just sort of a magical confluence of everybody just sort of understanding the assignment and hitting on all cylinders sort of right here in the middle of season six of Lost. And I think that makes it kind of special.
He, Gregory and Melinda wrote, Some Like It Hoth together, which is, you know,
it's a good one.
A great episode.
Yeah. And Tucker Gates is sort of like up and down with his Lost episodes, because you get stuff like The Substitute, which we just watched. That's a very good episode. I think Confidence Man was pretty good, right? If I remember all the way back.
Yeah.
And like Born to Run, but also did like I Do.
Yeah.
Is not in the top 10 of Lost episodes.
Tucker Gates is wig blind.
Which, again, also magical is the fact that of all the bad wigs we've seen, we didn't get any in this episode. This is like prime terrible wig potential, but whoever gave Nestor his wig was like, I am not going to fail you. I have failed everyone else on this show. But you are so beautiful, Nestor, that I will not fail you with a terrible wig.
Everyone came through.
Emily DeRaven's like down the hall, like, yeah, fuck you.
The servant man in the beginning has like what appear to be legit mutton chops. I want to know that extra story.
The whole thing. I think it's clear that most of the Canary Islands stuff is also shot in Hawaii. But they do a pretty good job of selling it, you know? They put in some real effort to sell that we're watching, you know, the 19th century origin story of Richard Alpert, and instead of just, you know, throwing on a couple cheesy costumes. Like, it's...
Yeah, no, the production design's good.
They really went for it with this episode in a way that they don't always go for it.
Yeah, and I do think this wasn't, like, quite a throwaway episode, because, like, based on the recaps I was reading earlier today, like, they were like, people have been really anticipating the Richard backstory episode. So I think they knew that, like, there was a lot of expectations around this episode. Right. And they had announced that this was the Richard episode, so people were, like, excited and wanting it
people
to
People were just
hit.
Starved of not, of anything that's not Jack. Just please not another Jack episode right now.
Yeah.
Speaking of.
Yeah.
Around the campfire, in what seems to be like it should be a bigger moment in another episode, Jack learns that there's a John Locke still walking around. Everybody seemed to have forgiven Ben. And Sun is now convinced that she's the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Where of I course believe she what is. She was what she was actually told was it's one of you.
No, that tracks with Sun's character. She's got some confidence, like deep
all
down.
All I'm saying is that's the least
confidence
that she's ever seemed interested in Jin in like literally 3 years.
She's like, ooh, I could have a new job here.
I could be the
Maybe
candidate.
Maybe we don't need to find
Here's
my husband.
Here's what I can set my watch by for most of these final season episodes. Sun is going to have one line, and after she says it, and here she has like kind of two, three, maybe even if you consider it. And after she says it, Frank's going to say something. And then that's going to be it for them.
That's it.
That's it.
But I do, I missed a good beachside campfire planning session. I don't know if I would strike it from this episode or add to it. I think I would add to it. Like, give me a little bit more of that campfire discussion.
Like, maybe know Alana in the hospital and just take that hospital time. And
yeah, who wanted to go back to there?
Yeah, you could.
At first I was like, oh man, did we talk about this in the calm and then see it here? But no, we saw it already in the incident right? part one, and this does not give us any more new information.
Yeah, we can't just have Alana say, Jacob visited me in the hospital, like at the campfire. Come on now.
I also love when Jorge, it's whoever says, like, who's Ricardus? It's like, use your powers of creative thinking, guys. It's Richard. He's right there.
Who's also, Ricardus? One on this island is even close to that.
When did Jacob start calling Richard Ricardus?
Right away, because Jacob and his weird thing with Latin.
Sure. When in reality, his name is Ricardo.
Yeah.
Jacob.
No, I think, even when he first meets him, I think he says, like, Ricardo, we have to talk. Like, what is your name? And he says, Ricardo. He's like, Ricardo, you have to talk. But, like, right at the top of the episode, he says, ask Ricardo. It's just, I don't know. Okay.
He just decided it's his, like, affectionate Latin nickname for him. And in the ways of all affectionate Latin nicknames, it adds letters to it.
Yeah. So if Ghost Jacob ever shows up, he's going to be like, greeting, Jackass.
Sure.
I think just one of the most important things we're learning about Jacob is that, like, on an interpersonal level, he sucks.
Yeah.
Like, it just sucks to hang out with this
dude. Did not develop any social skills growing up. Birthed into the world not knowing social skills.
Yeah, it's not very difficult to see why the man in black wants to leave. Because if it's just him and Jacob the whole time, you would also want to leave.
He's like this guy with his dried fish. And
yeah, he keeps calling me the man in blackus.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
I have a name, presumably. and, like, the other thing is, like, this episode could, like, it could have Nikki and Paulo'd it, right? Like, we could have seen Richard all through time. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad they decided instead to give him, like, just an origin story arc. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Rather than,
well,
like,
so that you can come back with the sequel series that's really a prequel series about Richard's years on the island.
Listen, Nestor still looks great.
Yeah,
so
he's very timeless.
It does take a lot of restraint to not give him one scene with Dogen just to define that relationship.
Sure.
To me.
But also,
clear up the orc chart.
Yeah. Just, come on.
Do you think that that's where Dogen got the rule that he gave Saeed, if he speaks, it'll already be too late? Do you think that came from Richard? And do you think that, I guess now, since we originally got it from the Men in Black, it feels like something that might be true, right? Because last week, or the week before, whenever Saeed tried to stab John Locke, we were arguing whether or not it actually mattered that he said any word first, right? Versus, like, if he just started talking, the magic is gone.
Yeah.
So it draws a line, at least, to where Dogen got the rule from Richard, and Richard got the rule from the Men in Black. I still don't know if that seals whether or not it's a real rule.
It doesn't. And the knife, presumably. Dogen got the knife and the rule, and he buried it in a plant, and he was like, this works for both sides.
Also,
right?
as far as we've seen, it worked zero times. We have no empirical scientific evidence that this dagger does anything.
It's so weird.
Yeah, this may also be where Dogen got the idea to bury the knife, because Richard seems like the kind of guy whose first idea is, like, bury it. Oh, you got a necklace? Bury it.
Gotta bury it. Yeah.
You got a knife?
This bench.
Bury it.
Well, again, it's 1867. He's not gonna build a hatch. You gotta work your way up to that technology.
I have a question. Can we talk about some rules stuff? particularly dead people rule stuff?
Sure.
Yeah.
So presumably the first time we see Isabella in the hold of the ship, that's the man in black pretending to be her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then she goes up the stairs and he's like, pretends to kill her. So, like, the man in black in a dual role as Isabella and the blacksmith that killed her. But thus far, we've only seen the man in black impersonate people who have died on the island, right?
That we know of. You know what? I'm going to go off topic here. This seems like a good place to play our official podcast clip from this week.
Oh.
Which has some shape questions. Let's give it a listen.
In the same way that the smoke monster can turn into a human being or a pillar of black smoke, can Jacob alternate between being a human being and being something else, potentially a 60-foot being made of flames?
Wow. Potentially. We have not seen Jacob demonstrate any shape-shifting behavior, nor have we seen a 60-foot being of flames, but I like the cut of your jib.
Doug, I want to be in your mind for like maybe 5 minutes, not longer than that, but that would be a very interesting sort of like a Disney ride.
What's
like
interesting,
a Disney park ride.
What's interesting about his question is that it shows you how limited the man in black's imagination is. He's like, let's see, I can be anything I want to. I could be a 60-foot being constructed of flames or Yemi.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go with Yemi.
Or Kate's horse.
Well, I'm not sure Kate's horse was the man in black, unless he just wanted Kate to ride him. But anything's possible. Can I say that?
Yes,
I could say
can.
That. Yeah.
I think it's worth speculating about. I'm not convinced that the Kate's horse was not the man in black.
So we almost got some rules, and then Carlton says, maybe there are no rules, right? That's
horse?
What I heard.
Horse? I think that's a silly answer from Damon, who's so smart generally, because of course it's much more effective to show up as Yemi than a giant pillar of flame. If your aim is to mess with Echo.
Yeah, it's harder to emotionally torture someone as a giant flame being.
That's very silly.
But I guess the idea is that he can take, or at least at this point, we don't know what the limits to his form are. My guess is it did that scan thing, a la the lock judging or the echo judging, and pulled Isabella out of his memory, and it was able to be covered.
No, totally. That's totally what he did, but, like, why isn't he Kate's dead dad?
Well,
you know what I mean?
Isn't he Ben's dead mom that was never on
the island? No, I thought that was different. I thought that was Ben seeing an actual ghost.
Has Ben seen any other ghosts, though?
No,
because,
but
Hurley seems to have the ghost power.
Did Ben ever meet the smoke monster before he saw his mom? Like, did he have a chance to get
Ben
skinned?
Ben says he met Ricardus when he was 12, which is Richard, when he was 12, which is when he was shot, which is not true. So in Lostpedia says maybe Ben's memory has been altered by going in the temple waters.
Oh, ye old Lipton iced tea pool.
Came back slightly wrong, but only...
Came back wrong.
Only in a way that fills plot holes.
But also, if Ben's never talked to Jacob because of how Jacob responds to him at the beginning of this season, if he encountered anything mysterious on the island, it was the man in black.
Follow-up question. I kind of thought that Hurley, in terms of seeing ghosts, that, like, the only ghosts hanging around the island were, like, island people. And so, what is Isabella doing there? Did she travel there in the cross? Like, what happened? Like,
well, but also...
She metaphysically linked them with her final words. I'm not joking. I don't think.
What were her final words?
Well, but her final words come after.
No. The Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award is before Richard runs off to get medicine.
To get the doctor.
It says, close your eyes, we'll always be together.
Okay,
well,
sure.
But also, Hurley's power is not limited to the island. Like, he was playing chess with Mr. Echo.
Totally.
When he was in California.
Yeah,
so.
I guess I feel, like, less weird about island ghosts coming off island than I do mainland ghosts coming to the island.
I think Hurley's connection is so strong. He's like a satellite phone for ghosts. Like, they can just show up wherever he's at.
I believe it. You tell me Hurley can fly, I believe it. I love that guy. That's fine.
Well, speaking of, if there is a performance that is excellent in these bookends, it's Jorge Garcia subbing in for a emotional translation. Basically, they're doing Ghost, and it works really well. Like, it could have been so bad.
I put that in the notes. I just put Ghost in the notes. Yeah, no, it does work. It works really well in Ghost, too, actually. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm crying right now thinking about that scene. It's so good.
Yeah, well, and they bring back the visual trick that they did. Remember how we complained about it when in the first Saeed episode,
yeah,
where they panned across his shoulders and everybody went from speaking Farsi to English?
Yeah.
But in this case, they bring back the same movement. It goes the other direction, and it's just a wonderful emotional moment for the audience. Yeah.
I love messing with languages like that just by like using the power of montage to get something across. In this case, Hurley, you know, deeply channeling what could only be the real Isabella to Richard in a way that he believes it and feels it. Or even something even simpler, like, I don't know, the 13th Warrior, where he's learning Viking around the campfire. Being able to do that visually, even though it's something that you would have to explain, great. Into it. Second Neil.
Just to head off emails, so he speaks Arabic.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. That's okay. No, I just double checked just so that we didn't get any emails about it. Yeah, and what I love is that, like, you know, I Hurley, because he speaks Spanish, like, you're just sort of like, he's so perfect because he speaks to Ghost and he speaks Spanish. Holy mm-hmm. shit. It just feels so satisfying, right?
And he tells Jack to get lost in the first scene,
yeah,
which I think is great. It's a very powerful moment for Hurley. Like, I don't think we can underestimate how cathartic it must be for Hurley when he gets to order Jack around. Like, hey, Jack, get out of here. This adventure's not for you, Jack. You don't have to insert yourself.
What about you, Jack? Yeah. But I also love that translation moment when, you know, she says in Spanish, like, you know, tell him his English is beautiful. And he's like, she says, your English is awesome, dude. And it's just like a Hurley translation. And it's so good. Yeah, Jorge's great. The actress who plays Isabella is also very good, I think, with very little screen time. But it's hard to pick. Like, Nestor, obviously MVP, but like Titus Welliver is bringing it. Jorge Garcia is bringing it. This woman playing Isabella.
Mark
Pellegrino is also there.
Making maybe a supernatural joke. Somebody, it must have been like on a recap or a Lostpedia thing, a rewatch recap, I would imagine. Did he play the devil in Supernatural? Yeah,
he did.
So is that why he pauses and smiles when Richard asks him if he's the devil?
I was about to say, like, could he have already been playing the devil in Supernatural? But of course, Supernatural was on for 1 million years. So yes, possibly he had already appeared as the devil in Supernatural.
Interesting. Mm. Interesting. Television, you're full of questions.
What was really funny is that this week in TV, Morelli Taylor is the actress who played Isabella. This same week on TV that opens it with Richard in Tenerife, there was like there's a episode of Breaking Bad where Walter White like gives a speech about this great airline disaster in Tenerife, and every single recap I read mentioned it. Everyone was like, and if you're watching Breaking Bad, Tenerife showed up there, and I was like, all right, guys, wow. So that's just like a funny little relic of time that you know,
everyone was talking about it. We'd be talking about The Sideways as a variant universe or something if it was airing right now. It's television rolls, and it's fantastic.
Does right. Walter White exist in The Sideways?
Oh.
Ooh. Stay tuned to The Storm to find out.
That's the huge crossover in the finale that makes it very divisive. Mm-hmm. It's when Walter White shows up, starts knocking on everything. All right, it's time for some corners. Neil, our Giacchino corner overfloweth.
Yeah, I think this week we're going to focus a little bit less on talking about the music itself, and we're going to focus on the titles, because even though the maestro, Mr. Giacchino, has been... We've had some bland stuff on the season 6 soundtrack so far, but he really, in on brand with this episode, really kind of goes for it here. So I want to see which of these is your favorite. I will read them. I believe there are like 6. The first one is called None the Richard.
Nice.
Because he's poor. Get it? The other one is called Love in a Time of Pneumonia, which I guess answers my question from my recap, which is what specific disease kills Richard's wife? I guess it's pneumonia. Then there's another track called The Fall of Man, which I believe can be taken metaphorically and literally because a ship full of men falls onto the island. Then there's Dead Man Talking. There is another track called Jacob's Advocate. There's one called Standing Offer, which is to signify the Man in Black's ongoing desire to have Richard on his team. And the final one, And Death Shall Have No Dominion, which has a real biblical feel for this biblically themed episode, for sure. But which one do you think is the best episode-themed pun of these, Joanna?
I mean, Love in the Time of Pneumonia, I because we made so many Love in the Time of COVID jokes this last year, is tempting, but I gotta go with None the Richard, and also it's an incredible track. Like, I know we're saying we're talking about the titles, but like, I have to shout out the Richard theme. Like, you kind of thought that like Lost was done with all of its themes by the time we're halfway through the final season, but the Richard theme is beautiful, and it comes up a lot in this episode, and so I'm all in on None the Richard.
Yeah. This is a real good sort of crescendo for Richard as a character, right? He's been out in the sidelines. Now he's got his own theme. He's got his own episode. He has the ability to make us cry whenever he wants.
And he has a new purpose.
Great stuff. And he has a new purpose and mission that is related to hell.
From his ghost wife.
From his ghost wife.
Leonardo DiCaprio would be so proud. King of the ghost wives.
This week's Jungle of Mystery moment is the island is a cork.
Cork, 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 cork. Mm-hmm.
Take with that information and do what you will.
What is it holding in? Evil.
Evil.
Also, a fine Cabernet.
Right, right. And the vacation dreams of the Man in Black. He just wants to go to one cold place before the end of his immortal life. I don't know.
The dumb, elaborate artifact of the week. We already touched on this, but there's that dagger again. Does it work? Who knows? Maybe someone will get to use it in the future.
The very ornate, it's Roman, right?
We talked about that in the storm, but I think we can say in the calm that, yeah, it appears to be Roman in origin.
The Boone Carlyle Memorial Falling Down Award. Neil brought up the whole BlackRock, which I honestly didn't think about. That's pretty good. But I was going to give it to Jacob's Tarot statue.
I think that's even better.
I mean, they go together. It's a ship full of dudes and a statue all fall down at the same time.
It's a real hot pocket in the wall moment. You know what I mean?
It is the most falling down that we've seen on Lost.
Guess I'm out of the book club. We're going to either go with the Bible, specifically Richard's reading Luke, which, as Joanna has mentioned in a previous episode, is the part that he's reading is the Jesus's temptation in the desert. And then, you know, Richard goes to an island and gets tempted a couple of times. So there's that and the stand. But we're going to throw in Gerald's Game. A lot of Stephen King there. Allusions, even though no actual books besides the Bible show up.
King James, Stephen King, a lot of kings.
Oh, a lot of kings.
Showing up.
The Abs, a Turtle Award. I called this because I got to the document first. And of the Richard looks, I'm going to take Returning from the Beach, Newly Immortal Ricardus. Because the facial hair is perfect. He's a little wet, but not like dripping wet. And just like the second the Man in Black sees him, he's like, you look too good to have just murdered the person I told you to murder.
He's got that I will now live forever kind of confidence.
He's got that I just got a new job glow.
Bad news, didn't stab anybody. Good news, new job. Here's a rock. See you later. But the Ben's talking, so it's obviously a lie award. Doesn't go to Ben, but does go to Jacob when he says to Alana, ask Ricardus, he'll know what to do next. Dude, you didn't tell him anything.
Which is immediately followed by Richard freaking out because he's like, I have no idea what's happening.
Nestor's so funny.
Just laughing, like, ha ha ha.
Oh, you sweet summer child.
I love you.
It's time for the Jungle of Kistery, where we decide who needs to be kissing. In Lost, last week, we had a episode that was heavy on the shirtless Sawyer. It was Recon. I also left the poll open for an entire week, but it didn't seem to matter. Joanna, how did you do with Recon?
Listen, a lot of people tried, but they all failed. The poll is still technically open, but we know no one's going to beat our front runners. So we've got Sawyer and Widmore, 3.9% of the vote. That's a real Dave Chaos entry there. James and Charlotte, your classic hot hetero pairing, 7.2% of the vote. Charlotte with her sparkly first date dress. Sawyer and a new sub, 22.2% of the vote. Once again, feels like a real Dave Chaos entry. But running away with the whole thing, it is Officer Ford and Officer Miles. Ford and Miles, our favorite buddy cop ACAB show, 66.7% of the vote currently. Clear winners.
And I think everyone just wanted them to have a little smooch after they sort of made up in the car at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
It was ruined by Kate showing up and crashing into them. So,
Kate.
Give it a rest, Kate.
Yeah.
You've won plenty of your own kisses.
Stop running, Kate. You're fucking it up for some people.
The Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award, as we mentioned previously, go to Isabella. Close your eyes, we'll always be together. And then at the end, she reminds him while his eyes are closed, and it all works. Good job, television writers. The Frank Lapidus, guess we're not going to Guam Act Break Award, goes to The Man in Black. Says, that's right, I'm afraid there's only one way to escape from hell. You're gonna have to kill the devil. And Richard gives that agape mouth, look that he's so good at, and we're off in between act 4 and 5. And I think, you know what? Let's just hear from Nestor and Joanna. Let's see what he has to say about Ab Eterno.
Hi, Joanna here. Just a quick note about our interview with the great Nestor Carbonell. You might hear some drilling sounds and some dog sounds on this track. Listen, we're living in a Zoom era. We did our best, but there were a few interruptions, which is fine. None of them are overwhelmingly or loud or long, I think. The other thing is, Nestor did talk a little bit about some spoilery stuff. So that means we split off part of this interview and we'll drop it at the end of the storm section. So you'll hear most of what Nestor has to say here in the calm section. Talk a lot about Ab Eterno, obviously. But then, you know, we got a little spoilery at a little chunk at the end. So you'll hear that at the very end of this episode. So here is part one, I suppose, of our interview with Nestor Carbonell. Nestor, welcome to the show. Hello, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me, Joanne. It's a pleasure to Zoom meet you. This is very nice.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm so happy to have you here for a million different reasons, but this is going to sound made up, but it is true that Ab Eterno is like a top five, maybe even top three Lost episode for me. I love this episode so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It was a gift for me for sure. And, you know, I remember when I got a call from Carlton before that, you know, we would get the episodes hand delivered to us. This is when they were so careful about being secretive, you know, not letting any secrets out. So the scripts were hand delivered. They weren't emailed. And I remember getting a call from Carlton basically saying, by the way, a script is coming your way. I think you're going to like it. You're finally going to find out, you know, your origin. And he was just so excited about it. So it was sweet to get the phone call, but I had no idea what to expect when I was given the script. But I was just, I mean, as soon as I started reading it, I was like, oh my God, this is epic in scope. And you know, I hope I can deliver here. Cause there's, it was just a lot of great stuff. Just, you know, the world that they created for him, his backstory, the journey, the emotional arc. It was just everything an actor can wish for.
I was telling Damon Lindelof, who's been like really kind supporting this podcast, that it was Abaterno week. And he was like, oh, he was like, Nestor found a new gear on that one. so I'm just wondering, like, you know, what did you dig into? There's so much emotion in your performance in this episode. So what did you dig into to deliver for this episode?
Well, thank you. And thank you, Damon. That's very kind. When you train as an actor, you're always trained for high stakes, you know, and you don't always get to play them. But you're always, it's almost like an athlete when you're working out on stage, you're working out in a class, you're working those sort of, you know, for us, it's imagination. It's using your imagination to sort of create to realize this fantastical world and make it as real as possible. But the stakes are always life and death. You know, it's always the highest stakes. You always train for that. You don't always get to play it. You know, most of the time it's a lot of simple reality. Occasionally you play something really dark. But this particular episode called for so much of that, sort of heart-wrenching turns, you know, mistakes and redemption and major loss and basically signing a deal with the devil. I mean, these are there are high stakes at every turn. So, you know, it was for me, it was that was the greatest gift of all, you know, was getting to play those high stakes and then. You know, and then having the space to do it. You know, we were given 8 days to shoot each episode of Lost. You know, sometimes we'd go over a little bit. And this particular episode, we were given more time because, okay. You know, it was period. There was a lot of stunts in terms of horseback riding. There was huge sets that needed to be built. So we got it. We did have the luxury of a little bit more time. But just the nature of it, allowed me to go back and say, hey, this is a chance to go back to the way you used to train and really dive in and really stretch my imagination as much as I could, and a chance to use my Spanish, which I hadn't used in a while.
dust it off. I want to ask you about the Spanish in a second, but first I want to sort of go back to this idea of imagination, because, you know, I've seen you give a number of interviews about Lost in which you said, you know, they would hand you a script and you would go, oh, I didn't know that about my character. No one ever told me that. You know, you're learning sort of week to week along with the audience sometimes about the character. So I'm wondering, you know, given how many revelations there are in this episode about Richard's faith, about this great love of his life, all this sort of stuff, how did that square with sort of the backstory you had to create for yourself over the years to understand Richard, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I would never have guessed, you know, I would never have guessed that he came from Tenerife, that he came over on a Black Rock. You know, all I knew I had to work with was the fact that he didn't age, you know, and I assumed, you know, he was immortal, but how he became that way, no clue whatsoever. Right. I imagine Jacob had something to do with that. But I think the biggest surprise was the world coming from Tenerife, this sort of, you know, a farmer, a peasant, you know, a man of humble origins. That was like, oh my God, I've got to wrap my mind around that, because Richard, you know, as he was presented when he first appeared in Juliet's flashback in season three, he was a sort of polished guy, you know, seemed educated with, you know, spoke English, you know, fluently without an accent. And then suddenly I'm having to sort of wrap my mind around the fact that this English was not this guy's first language, you know, that was the and then his humble origins and, just every aspect of him. So that didn't square with what I thought Richard was at all,
right.
But I loved it, because there's no greater gift to an actor than to have an enormous arc like that. And then, to be able to play, you know, Z and have, you know, the entire alphabet at your disposal, you know, in an episode dedicated to your life, was, I knew how big a gift that was. So when Damon so kindly said, I found another gear, you know, he's right. And when you get an opportunity like that, you sort of dig in there and you go, yeah, you know, let's find that gear that I may not have used ever on TV, you know, maybe in class, but certainly not in TV. And luckily they gave me the opportunity, and then to have Tucker Gates, with whom I would work many years later on Bates Motel,
yeah.
was yet another gift, you know, this incredible script, and then Tucker at the helm, and the obviously incredible cast was yet, there were more gifts piled on top of this one.
It's funny. We were sort of digging into that because like this episode, is so good. And it is written and directed by people that don't get a lot of like light shone on them in terms of their contributions to Lost. You know, they're not like people talk about Jack Bender or Stephen Williams, you know, because they directed right. so many episodes, but Tucker doesn't get talked about a lot, even though he's directed a couple of my favorites. So I guess, yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, having worked with him a ton on Bates, yeah. you know, what are Tucker's gifts as a director?
I mean, Tucker's an artist, you know, Bender is as well, and Stephen Williams, they're all incredibly gifted, and they're all, their aesthetics just, and, you know, extraordinary, all of them. He's so conscious of the frame, you know, in a way that it's applicable to story, not in a way to draw itself, attention onto itself, in a way to sort of, to move story along, but he's very conscious of telling the story visually, and really feeling the world, you know, I could see that when we shot on Bates, what he did on Abiterno is that he doesn't use a lot of long lenses, you know, not to get too technical.
No, get technical. I love it.
Okay. Because he, and I know on Bates, he didn't want to use anything more than a 40 millimeter lens, you know, for a close up, you know, that's about as long a lens as he would use because he wanted to see the world. You know, when you use a long lens, you know, you usually, the camera's way far away and you're trying to sort of make the background disappear and make the actor look better, you know, because everything just gets compressed the yeah. longer the lens. So he would use a 24 on our close-ups and it would give us a little bit of a fisheye look, but you really saw the world, you know, and there's a richness to that, to see the character in context of the world that does. So he's very conscious about painting that world. And I did rewatch the episode because I knew I obviously was going to talk to you. So I, uh-huh. you know, it'd been a number of years and I marveled at how he made Makaha and so many aspects of Hawaii make, you know, and, I mean, look, it's so rich to begin with, but how he made it seem like it was, you know, 200 years, you know, ago,
yeah.
You know, that and an incredible art department. But visually, the way he framed, the way, you know, and also the way it's, you know, he uses a lot of lovely dolly moves to push tension. You know, there are things that I learned from him because I started directing as a result of, mm-hmm. of him and Carlton and Cary Aaron opening that door for me. But the way he pushes tension with slow dolly pushes, and then the way obviously he directs actors. You know, he doesn't micro sort of direct, you know, he allows you to play in a certain world and allows you to find it without sort of, nitpicking at every little thing. And so you discover more things like that. You have that freedom. So it was a real, really beautiful experience to get to do that with Tucker. And we were sort of doing it in a vacuum because with the exception of the first scene and the last scenes of the show, really it was most of that episode was backstory. So we kind of felt like we were on our own little island doing this little sort of period piece.
Yeah.
And so that was yet another gift.
Yeah. It's like its own little movie with a bookend. Yeah, absolutely. Let's go back to the Spanish thing. What did it mean for you? I mean, we love talking about Lost and the precedents it set, right? And it was such a big deal when Lost first premiered that you had characters speaking in Korean at all in like primetime, you know, television, stuff like that. And similarly, the amount of Spanish is spoken in this episode, at the time, I think, felt revolutionary and now the needle has moved, I think, a bit more in terms of what audiences are ready for.
Sure.
But what did it mean to you for this episode to be so largely in Spanish?
I loved it. I mean, I loved it. And yeah, one of the great things about Damon and Carlton and, you know, and JJ and all of the writers is that they never talked down to the audience and they never assumed that the audience wasn't ready for what they had in mind. And sure enough, you know, they're, hypothesis was proven true. You know, the fan base was enormous and people were looking for things in every aspect of the writing and they knew they would. And sometimes they're like, well, we didn't really intend that.
That
book in the background was really the prop department just came up with a book.
right.
But by and large, they did. They did a lot. There's so much richness, so many Easter eggs in every episode and in every frame. They did, and they never talked down. And that, and certainly having a character, you know, speak in Spanish or, you know, with an entire, almost an entire episode. I wasn't terribly surprised that they did it because they took so many chances, but I was so, it was just, it was beautiful. It's beautiful to get to do that. I love that they chose Tenerife, which is a part of Spain where the accent is not too dissimilar to a Cuban accent,
yeah.
You know, which is what my parents, you know, my parents are from Cuba. So that, sorry if you hear the drilling in the background.
That's okay, that's all right.
there's a dentist next door. No, it sounds like it now. But anyway, they stopped.
Okay.
So yeah, no, that was a gift. That was a tremendous gift. And I think I had to translate. I think some of it was already translated, but I think I went in there and with the help of my parents sort of went in and just sort of massaged a little bit of the language. But I think they did most of the translation. And that was just so much fun. It was just so much fun to have that adventure in Spanish.
I was looking at an interview you gave at the time, and at the time you were remembering not so fondly the fact that you had to shoot with an actual giant wild boar or a boar of some kind. Tell me about the day you spent with that boar on Lost.
That was so funny. You know, because I remember, yeah, they were bringing this. I remember reading it, thinking, okay, well, then maybe they'll CGI that part. I don't know. But sure enough, that the boar showed up. I think they really wanted to have the boar there. But then the boar was just, you know, there was a boar wrangler, of course, and, you know, everyone was treating it well and everything was doing, but the boar was just not cooperating. It was just not a particularly well-trained boar. Did not go to acting school. And so, but I remember that they even had a hard time sort of getting the boar onto the ship, you know, on the planks, and it took a number of men to do it. And finally, they did. And I remember being chained, you know, there and thinking, okay, it's going to charge me. But sure enough, the wrangler was like a 10, 15 feet away from me. And I'm going, that thing charges me. Can you at least maybe like, can we fake like I'm actually like handcuffed? Can you give me a half a shot here? Cause I don't think you're going to make it in time. But you know, oddly enough, it was just such a challenge to get that thing to move at all. And I just watched it. It looked like it came really close to me. And I don't know how they were able to achieve that. I can't remember how it happened. I do remember they did. It took a long time, but they finally got the boar to move. God bless his soul. But yeah, I remember being genuinely terrified. So if I looked at it, I was pretty terrified at that point.
Was that the hardest day of filming this episode, or rewatching it? Were you like, oh, that day? Oh my gosh.
No, you know, it's interesting. The physical stuff is kind of fun in the sense that it, yeah, I mean, it's draining, you know, but it's, that's all, you know, because that almost makes it easier. Yeah. You're playing the truth of your physicality, you know, and you're really training and you're chained and you're really trying to get out of there. Yeah. The hardest stuff I think is sort of suspending disbelief. You know, those are the, you know, I remember when the smoke monster came into the ship, there was a gentleman there who, you know, special effects gentleman it was a green ball, and he was sort of holding it with two sticks, I want to say. And I had it was a metal ball. It's like a metal ball. And I had to stare at the metal ball, not stare at the guy. And those are the things that, you know, those are the trickier aspects of, you know, of really suspending, you know, disbelief. And a lot of it is also in story because there's so much fantastical stuff that is sort of thrown at the viewer and also the characters and turns that you just have to make that adjustment, you know? And so those are the bigger challenges. The physicality, it's like a workout, you know, it's kind of, you know, when it's going to end and it's fine. But I think the tougher stuff, at least for me, was trying to go to these sort of these enormous places, you know, and sort of, you know, wrap my mind around these incredible turns.
I wanted to ask you about, obviously there's this beautiful romance in this episode. Lost is famous for its, you know, tragic love stories. This is one of my favorites. maybe my favorite. Desmond gets a lot of credit for waiting 8 years, but Richard is like still holding that torch 150 years later, you know? So
she's a woman. She's a very special one.
You only had an episode to sell us on that. And so I'm just wondering sort of how you approach a challenge like that.
You know, I think I was so lucky, and I'm, it's Murray, right? Am I pronouncing? Because yeah. I only got to meet Murray on that episode and really like a day before we started shooting, if not this, the very first day we started shooting. And knowing that, I was like, oh, I've got a great partner. You know, this woman has so much depth and she's so open. And when you meet an actor like that, when you're having to do stuff like this, it's just such a great relief because I was like, I don't have to have known her for long. I just know that, you know, Vera Farmiga is the same way. Mm. You know, she's such an open soul. Belle Powley, I worked with on Morning Show, another open soul. That actors like that, you build almost an instant history because they're so accessible emotionally and they're so open to you and the trust is there. So I was like, yes, okay, great. You know, we'll be able to open up to each other, you know, and sort of, you know, and kind of endow some history to our relationship. But no, she was tremendous. She was extraordinary. And I think, you know, a lot of that is sort of, you know, I know you mentioned it before, is like doing your own history, you know, even though I wasn't, even as I'm getting the script for Abiterno and finding my history, you still have to add history on that, you know, of your relationship. And that's stuff you do in the margins, you know, like, you know, how did we meet, all that stuff. And that's sort of just actor stuff, you know, you're like, yeah, you're trying to build a history that will resonate with you personally, so that it is as real as it can be to you as an actor. So that was always fun to do, is just, you know, finding how these guys met, you know, what she meant to him, what he meant to her.
There's that lovely three-hander at the end of the episode with the two of you and Jorge. And I'm just wondering, I mean, Jorge is also such a beautiful, like, sensitive performer. Every scene with Hurley, you're just sort of, your heart is open.
Yeah.
What was it like having Jorge there in that scene?
It was amazing. Jorge's such a great guy on top of everything. I mean, he's so terrific and such a good soul. And I remember the three of us, we were so weird because you were in this period garb. He wasn't at the time. I think actually I wasn't at that time in that scene. She was, you know, but we were in like, they have the chairs, like the, you know, the little director chairs with the name on them. And you're in the middle of a jungle. The three of us. I think this was towards the end of that shoot. The three of us are sitting there and I'm thinking, this is just such a weird sort of grouping of my wife, who's deceased, who's now a ghost. Mm-hmm. I'm in a chair in present time. You know, I'm 100, 200 plus years old. And here's Hurley, present day Hurley.
Yeah.
Who's going to translate for my ghost to me. Mm-hmm. And it was, but we were so quiet. I remember us, the three of us sitting there so quiet because we knew that scene was going to be tough. And Jorge was just so sensitive to that because he knew that it was just going to be it. And it was just a beautiful day for me. And I hope it was for him because, you know, those are the moments that those are the days you remember. You go, oh, I remember that scene meant a lot to me. And the care of the people around you sort of, you know, create that environment that you can open up and you can have sort of this, the character can have this moment and the actor can facilitate that. So Jorge, the crew were incredible about knowing, oh, wow, okay, what this particular scene means, you know, and allowing it to sort of to come to life, you know.
So Lost has had its share of wigs, not all of which stand the test of time, but you lucked out, my friend, because you had a great wig for this episode, I think. And I was just wondering if you could talk to me about the look, designing the look, the beard, the costume. It's a great costume too. You look great in it. So like, what, designing this past Richard look, what do you remember about that?
I remember I went through a series of wigs. I remember going through a series of wigs on the when I did that flashback with a young Linus, and mm-hmm. I had sort of this wig that it made me look kind of like Jesus. I had sort of this sort of, and I remember Jack Bender was weighing in on that wig. And I think we showed him three or four or five wigs. I don't know. Finally, we settled on that one. I thought, I think that one is a winner, you know? And I thought, oh, I'll have something similar to that. But no, they actually, that one they built from scratch. Yeah. You know, that was an old wig that I just got from somewhere else. so they built this sort of wig, and they designed it in a way that it would sort of follow my hairline and be as realistic as possible. And it made sense. It felt kind of the period too. Mm-hmm. So they spared no expense with that, in terms of like the look and trying to, evoke the period and the feeling, the vibe. So that and the wardrobe was sensational. You know, I don't know how you dress an immortal guy, in present day, but somehow the Dockers seem to work, somehow I bought it. I bought, what they did in wardrobe, in present day and in the past. They hired some of the most incredibly talented people. But the wig was the one thing that I did walk away from. So I still own that wig.
Oh, you did. Did you, and is that your beard or did they?
That was my beard. Yeah, that was my beard. I had a little bit of, I did get a heads up in terms of how much time I had to grow it. So they were able to sort of schedule it, so that I would do my scenes in present day at the end so I could shave. That was definitely my beard.
I love that you have your Averno wig. That cracks me up. I know you had talked about wanting to take the compass away from the show, and that they sold it out from under you or something like that, right?
The compass, I wanted the cross from Isabella. I didn't get the cross. And the wig just fell off the truck. I don't know how it landed in my lap, but it just fell off the truck. But I don't think anyone needs it right now. So
what a crazy random circumstance. That's amazing.
I know.
Of course I want to talk to you about this enduring legacy of Lost. And I know you guys recently had this sort of Lost reunion. I am fascinated doing this podcast by A, how important the show remains to so many people, and B, how many people are still discovering it. So, how what is it like for you to be part of that legacy?
I mean, I'm so lucky. I feel so blessed and lucky to have been on this incredible journey. Yeah, I mean, these are the things you dream about. You never know if it's ever going to happen to be a part of a show like this that, broke so much ground. I mean, it was, I know you've talked about it before, about how much ground it really broke at the time. I think certainly for network, and really cable was in its infancy at the time. I think Sopranos, was right around, sort of aired right around the time Lost did. So that was breaking ground for cable series. But for network, nothing had ever been done, not to the scope, the serialized scope, and the crossing of genres in the same way that Lost, I think, had done it. And it really sort of paved the way for the growth of network television and television in general. So to be part of that, to me, was monumental. I remember my wife and I, my wife was an actress, she quit after her second child was born because she wanted to be there for both our kids. But I remember she said, Lost is her favorite show. And she said, if either one of us gets that a guest star on that show, we're all going to Hawaii. Okay. So, little did I know it was actually going to happen, and it happened for me. So we didn't get to go to Hawaii on that first one because his kids were in school, but thankfully they brought me back and we eventually ended up moving there, when I was made a series regular, certainly the last season, we've all moved there.
Yeah, so you're right. Your wife wrote this incredible book, All Is Not Lost, about that experience, about moving to Hawaii, about the decision to, put your career aside for kids, how tough that is for anyone to do. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, what you love most about that book and what you think Lost fans would love to find in that book.
Thank you. The book, Shannon bears her soul in this book. It is, she started journaling. I don't want to give away too much from the book, but she was in a really dark place when she sort of makes a parallel of it. She felt like she crash landed on the island, and she told me she was just going to be lost in the midst of me shooting Lost, because she had felt this sort of vacuum, and felt awfully guilty about it, about giving up on her career for full-time motherhood. This creative vacuum, giving up on her lifelong dream of being an actor. And it's a decision that a lot of, mothers and fathers make, in favor of full-time parenting. But it comes at a cost. It comes at a cost to your sense of self, your identity, your own unfulfilled ambition, your ego. And those are things that you have to, if you don't reconcile, that they'll really eat away at you and really hurt your relationships. So Shannon was in utter pain. You know, you would never know it to meet her, but it was obviously something that she was struggling with emotionally. And so she started journaling. And I remember, you know, shooting Abiterno and, you know, even during that whole time, I was barely home, but I remember those are, you know, she was going through a lot of tough times. And then beautiful things started to happen on the island for her. Mm-hmm. Incredible, beautiful things that sort of mirrored a lot of the stuff that a lot of the characters on the island, on the show actually happened. And she makes some parallels in the book, but there was mysticism, this magical quality of and healing properties of Oahu, setting aside how beautiful it is, of course, yeah. And that it just looks like paradise. There's something about it. You don't know whether it draws beautiful souls to the island or the souls are already there, you know? And so she, as big a lost fan as she was having this sort of all these epiphanies and all these things were coming to her. And that year was an enormous year for all of us, you know, not only for me to get to do the show, but for Shannon and for our boys. It was an enormous year of growth, you know, and an emotional growth. And I think fans of Lost will get a lot from the book, because whether you're a mother or father who's had to give up anything, it really will speak to anybody who's felt lost at all in their life, who's ever had to make any kind of compromise that you know, where their sense of identity was somehow sort of lost and they had to sort of redefine themselves.
I think it's something that we're only really starting to talk about in terms of like women and mothers. I remember there's a scene, I'm sorry if it sounds off topic, but, and I think it was like season one of Big Little Lies. I think it's, you know, Reese's character talking about how, you know, how guilty she feels that just being a mom isn't enough for her, and how that's it's a taboo thing, because you're supposed to just be, you know, that's supposed to be this transformative, you're grateful for everything, and you are, but there's a lot you trade for it. You know what I mean? And I think
there's no question. And I think the pull for, you know, for women in particular, for, you know, either full-time motherhood, and Shannon makes the point that she didn't write this book to sort of weigh in on the mommy wars, you know, and it's, sure. you know, it's just career and no kids, or career women can't be good mothers, because she acknowledges, no, many are good mothers. And she doesn't know what the right combination is. How much do you devote to a career versus motherhood?
Yeah. And I think it's really smart to draw that parallel to Lost, because I think that, you know, in this episode itself, Mark Pellegrino's character, Jacob, says something about like bringing people to the island and what happened before doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And you're on this journey here now on this island, you know, and framing the entire story of Lost in that way, where we've met all these characters, Richard included, where we make assumptions about them. We learn about their backstories, and we learn that, you know, the choices they make here and now on this island is really what matters most. Do you know? And so this idea that your wife comes to this island and is sort of like, okay, what does my journey from here look like? It's smart, you know?
It's so glad you drew that parallel. You're absolutely right. It is about that. It's about the here and now. It's like, you know, the past, yes, is important only as it informs your next decision in the present, you know? And you're here in the present, be in the present. Instead of dwelling on the pain, what are you going to do about it? First, I guess the first step is acknowledging it.
Yeah.
And then the second step is taking steps to heal and opening up your world and opening it. And that's what Shannon did. She opened herself up to so many experiences on that island, with meeting, you know, wonderful people on that island, that it would eventually sort of heal her and show her the way home. Not unlike the survivors of Oceanic 815.
I love that. I want to ask you about Richard's spirituality, because like that is such a big part. There's this moment, you know, speaking of like sort of new starts, there's this moment in this episode where he's essentially baptized by Jacob, right? Like dunked in water, you know, sort of thing, a saltwater baptism. And like Richard being so devout that he is terrified of going to hell, and that informs this choice he makes to live forever, sort of thing, is such an interesting and important, I think, part of the show, which deals so much in good, evil, faith, how it manifests across different characters. And there's only been a few characters that are super devout. I'm thinking of like Mr. Echo or, you know,
right.
Charlie's Catholicism, stuff like that. So, you know, looking back on the show and its approach to spirituality, like how does all of that sit with you thinking about the show in those terms?
I love that. And I love that the you know, Damon, Carlton, all the writers were, that they embraced it, that they said, look, all of these characters are unique. They're all moved by different things, whether it's religion, whether it's, you know, spirituality, whether, you know, whether it's relationships, you know, be they devout, be they atheist, it didn't matter. They weren't judging. They were just sort of informing, you know, the audience as to what moved these characters, you know, and certainly Richard was a devout a character. I would like to think also that a lot of, he was absolutely devout, but that his decision not to go to hell, not to want to go to hell, was also driven by his love to see Isabella, to be with Isabella, you know? So much of that was like, well, I'll never see her if I'm in hell, not to mention hell would really suck.
Yeah, sure. Would.
But absolutely. There's no question that he was devout. He knew he'd sinned, you know, he was constantly praying, you know, when he was incarcerated, he was praying as he was going towards to see his fate. He was later sold into slavery. You know, he was praying on it. He was constantly praying, asking for forgiveness from the priest to be absolved from his sin, who wouldn't absolve him of murder. So he was absolutely devout. And I love that. I love that they leaned into that, you know, and I love the themes of the show. I mean, the show's so Shakespearean in scope. It's all about, you know, good and evil, and about, and how much of that is within us. You know, Jacob talks about that too, about, you know, I'm not here. I can't guide them to be good. I wouldn't want to do that, which is why he hires me and taps me. Maybe you can show them the way.
Yeah.
So I love that the show leaned into all of that, you know, and all aspects of it. So there truly was something for everyone, you know, in that respect. If you were devout, you could certainly relate to those characters that were. If you weren't, you certainly related to the ones that weren't. But I love that they made each character specific in terms of their spirituality and their faith.
Something I feel increasingly every single time I go through the series is I'm increasingly frustrated with Jacob, I will say, because you know, this corrupt priest who does not absolve Richard and sells him into slavery is one thing. But I'm like, Jacob, why can't you absolve Richard? He's asking for absolution. Have some pity on the guy. You know what I mean?
Just doesn't have that power. Just doesn't. Yeah. I mean, he's got a lot of powers, but that absolution is not one of them. I don't know. I mean, I was hoping there would be a better choice. I guess I took the lesser of the evils that were afforded to me.
Immortality, I guess. You know.
I guess. I don't know. But, you know, that was a curse in and of itself. But I remember having to do that fight scene, and I knew he was like a black belt in karate or taekwondo. Oh, I can't remember which one. I'm thinking, this guy's going to destroy me. He was great. And then he gave me that baptism you were talking about. And we were in Makaha on the west side of the island of Oahu. And it's called Pray for Sex Beach because it's a fertility beach. People, you know, it sort of has that sort of history and mysticism attached to it. But I remember being on that, getting my baptism from Jacob and thinking, am I going to make it? Because the swell was pretty rough.
Oh, wow.
And then all the stuntmen were like, yeah, time to come in. but no, he was great. He was terrific. You know, he never let on that he was frustrated by his character's choices because he's such a great actor. But I think that was the beauty of the show, is that, you know, you're at once, you know, relieved and frustrated by the limitations of your character, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I kind of love that Jacob is such a often shitty, complicated deity. You know what I mean? That feels more real.
Exactly.
And then, you know, I've asked you about most of your scene partners, but I did want to ask you, of course, about working with Titus Welliver, who is so, so great in this role. And I was just wondering what it was like to work with Titus.
Titus was amazing. Titus was great. You know, we met again on that set. And, you know, like most sort of recurring or guest actors, he would come in and say, not sure why I'm saying this, but the thing, you know, I mean, but he, not, you know, a lot of the times we didn't know. We were guided sort of gently, emotionally by the director, you know, that week. No, I mean, I've never seen anyone commit more than than Titus. He was just fully committed, you know, and he's so good. He's so grounded. There's such truth to him, to his acting. And it was great to work with him. We have mutual friends in common that we talked about as well. But that's the great thing about actors, you know, and I do love that about actors, is that when you meet, and we met on that set, like I met Murray, and they're typically open. You can quickly form a bond. And, mm-hmm. and, it was pretty quick with Titus too. We hung out after that, you know, in LA as well. And he just open, accessible, you know, and obviously an enormous talent with him. I got Titus's accent work is unbelievable. Have you met him yet?
No, I haven't. No.
Have him do Pacino for you. I mean, okay. Or Walken. I mean, okay. It's like you're literally in the room with those two actors. He's you know, we did like a sketch on a sketch comedy theater in LA, and they wanted a bunch of lost actors, and he went in there and oh my God, he did a Pacino that was just unbelievable. So next time when you do meet him, please ask him to do it for you.
I will definitely do that. So, speaking of the spirituality aspect of the show, something that's fascinating to me, with this hindsight, is watching Carlton and Demon sort of split off and do whatever projects they did after, and then sort of trying to like work backwards and figure out how those particular approaches blended together to make Lost. Does that make any sense? So like,
yeah.
And you can see the thread that inquisitiveness about spirituality shine through in Damon's work going forward. Like that's a very clear thread. And I'm wondering, since you've worked so closely with Carlton on Bates Motel, you know, what is the particular ingredients that you feel like he brought to that Lost cocktail?
Oh, I mean, you know, it's such an interesting question because, yeah, you don't know, you know, tonally who gravitates to what. And I mean, I remember Carlton on Bates, just, you know, his overall sense of story is extraordinary, you know, and in terms of structure, he just knows it intuitively how to structure story. I think also his knowing when to open up the world. I remember season two, he's like, we need to open up the world now in a bigger way on Bates Motel. So he's got sort of big, huge, big picture, wonderful ideas, you know, and I think his sense of good and evil, you know, he loves to dabble in the gray, you know, there are moments where he's like, no, he'll lean on it. He will, you know, mm-hmm. This is a time to lean on that. So you saw that, and you saw sort of those extremes come to fruition on those characters on Bates Motel. And it's like, oh, I could see how he would have leaned in on certain roles, you know, on Lost. So yeah, I could see how you would sort of, you know, sort of glean that Damon probably leaned on the sort of the more spiritual end of things. And Carlton, yeah, I think for him, again, it's structure, story, and character as well. I mean, I remember having lunch with Carlton, you know, once, and he was telling me, I go, you know, Lost really was really a tremendous exercise in us getting to just develop great characters. You know, it was sort of, you know, I mean, and it was, if you look at the first few seasons, most seasons are flashback episodes or flash forward episodes where you're delving into history of characters. And he goes, and certainly, I know Damon isn't, you know, that's something he thrives on, but Carlton as well is really developing, you know, so you really can identify yourself in elements of that character. So character work is another one for sure.
Anyway, thank you so much for chatting with me. I really appreciate
it. You're awesome. Thank you so much. You've taken me back, and I'm so glad I was able to do this. And thanks to you for doing this.
And everyone can find your wife's wonderful book at Booksellers Everywhere, All Is Not Lost. So really recommend folks check it out. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Joanne.
Yeah. All right, now is the time on the podcast where we like to thank our small council subscribers. These are the folks that, these are our candidates. These are the folks who...
The podcast has to go on. We have to have an era where we call them candidates about a show we used to cover.
Yeah, let's call them candidates all through the next thing.
Yeah.
These are folks who contribute at the $10 level or above. They get everything we do, which is a lot all the time. So let's start by thanking some newcomers. We've got Sean C., Josh Darby, Melissa Shippey, Michael Mora, Lewis Walker, Adam Barnum, Claudia Davis, Chip Mims, Annette Minari, Anne Hasek, the lovely Anne, Julie Mahoney, Brian Oem, Will Wallace, L.M., Alexandria Wadsworth, Bryce, Mikhail, wow. I missed Mikhail, apparently.
It's Mikhail.
It's Mikhail.
Michael McGovern, Sophie Daly, Henry Berthelsen, Cecilia Nielsen, and Jennifer Clark. Thank you all so much. Especially Will, who was like talking about us on another podcast recently.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I saw that. Shout out to Will Wallace.
You're the best.
And I'd like to add some thanks. Dean Histhammer, Jose Cordova, Raymond McDaniel, G. Alex Bartrice, Hannah, Will Neville, Tone Kristen Languinet, I'm going to guess, Michael Caswell, James Bartha, Zim, Amy Randall, Reagan Hunter, Quick and Dirty Recordings, Kat Stromberger Perez, Lori Carmichael Howell, Caroline of the North, Patrick Grattan, Cindy M., Eric Carey, and Chris Biscard. Thank you guys very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Jenna Paul, Jackie Pawlowski, David Matheson, Trevor Ede, Sam D'Angelo, Doug Robson, Vera Johansson, Geir Arvishog Erikstad? I feel like I gave a good effort on that one. Maureen Marer, Rob Perry Hall, Michael R. Cleland, Cecily Stepney? All right, I think I nailed that one too. Matthew, Kaylee Hicks, David Moran, AJ Cabbage, Del Martinez, Mark Larson, Michelle Cahill, and Ben Grieving. Thank you all so very much for being small council candidates, however you identify.
And we're back for the storm. Pew, there we pew, go. Pew. Yeah, I didn't even have to ask for it. It just came washing over me like a Black Rock over a Tauret statue.
I have a storm question.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just more of a prediction for what we think the calm is. We did a lot of cork talk in the calm, but do you think that there is any way that they expect that there will literally be a cork by the end of
this
show?
You did say a plug to hell. Hell's plug, I think you said.
Yeah, which
really
is...
really setting the scene.
Yeah, which is really a much softer version of what was in my mind.
Ooh,
yeah.
Hell's butt plug?
Is that yeah. Like,
oh, okay.
but yeah, I mean, it's funny because like I like that they describe it as sort of a metaphorical cork in this episode. But then, woe to my surprise, by the end of this season, we will have dealt with the very cork that plugs the island's energy.
It was very hard during the calm to not be like, there's one more of these coming, but it's not successful. One more of these sideways stories that aren't about our main losties, but it's not going to work for you.
I don't know. I haven't rewatched Across the Sea yet. I'm not ready to weigh in on it being a terrible episode.
Yeah. I mean, we'll talk about it. I rewatched it because I already recorded our interview for that episode. Pre-recorded.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
And, you know, Titus Welliver is really good in that episode.
Yeah.
But it still sucks. But Titus Welliver is great in that episode. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Allison Janney's also in that episode.
She's also there.
It's funny to balance that versus this in terms of, like, we get this, and, like, maybe I want more about what the island is. I feel like I want more answers. And then I get it, I'm like, I was cooler with the cork in the wine bottle.
Yeah.
Like, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Are you something like, let the mystery be? That's a reference you'll get when you watch The Leftovers.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it be a metaphorical cork. That is a struggle between two godlike figures on this island.
Exactly. Do you want to hit some emails? Storm emails?
Let's hit the emails.
All right. I got a couple calm emails that I didn't read because, like, anyway, I should have. I just didn't. Declan wrote in and just said when we were talking about lost actors being good in other things, right?
Oh, we had an excellent answer.
Well, we have two things. First of all, I really should have talked about this on the calm. Kristen's going to kill me. First of all, Kristen dug up the fact that Josh Holloway appeared in an episode of Yo Gabba Gabba. I don't know if you guys saw this.
Oh, it was the highlight of whatever day she sent it out.
Farmer Josh.
And he does a song. So if you haven't watched that yet, please do watch Josh Holloway.
Yeah,
play I believe Farmer Josh.
My response on Twitter was hashtag Josh Holloway country album when.
Yeah, he's good.
Which is what I would really like to know.
He's really good. But Declan wrote in and mentioned something that we didn't, but of course it is very near and dear to all of our hearts, which is Sawyer showing up as a cowboy on Community. So,
Oh yeah.
Josh paintball Holloway. Episode.
Josh Holloway in it's the second paintball episode or the third?
Bear Down for Paintball.
I think it's the second one.
It's like Ace is Wild or something like that. Anyway, yeah, that's some good shit. And then Aaron sent me, I mean, I'm assuming it's mostly for me, but it's for all of us. He sent me a screenshot of a crossword puzzle that he was working on. And it's a four-letter answer, and the clue he gave was 71 across, travels inside a guitar case.
It's an onk.
Onk, onk,
it's
onk.
It's an onk. It's an onk with a short list of names inside. For some stupid reason.
Fucking onk. All right. Then we've got some other answers. Do you want to start with the Pat email?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Okay. In defense of Jacob. Dear host. What an episode of Defend Jacob.
Yeah.
Dear host, although I hesitate to argue with another letter writer, everyone writing to the shows are heroes in their own way, I feel compelled to counter the slander, or is it libel, from an emailer last week suggesting that Jacob had engineered the high mortality rate among expectant mothers. The premise is that Jacob was reflecting his trauma on losing his mother and directing it magically into the island. If we accept this premise as valid, I think that's not a bad suggestion. My question would be, why are we charging Jacob with this deadly misogynist accusation when there are more likely candidates to consider? Jacob did not kill his mother. His brother did, who then became a magical murder genie. The man in black and Jacob's mother figure was a magical being in her own right and murdered by her adopted child. She's also guilty of murdering mother since she clobbered Claudia right after she delivered the baby boy in black. Why does it make more sense that bereft orphan Jacob is personally the architect of this anti-maternal situation than his mother-murdering brother? The man in black is shown to be malevolent and I'd also be interested to consider this as an unintended consequence of mother's trauma, being killed by her child. She's magic, she's killed by her kid, she's hooked into the island. The mortality of mothers on the island could be echoes of this trauma, which again, Jacob is innocent of. Is Jacob an asshole island god? Sure. We could agree or disagree, particularly where we fall on the island's power being something that needs protecting, or if it would even be a bad thing for the man in black to make his escape, but is Jacob a murderous misogynist? I'm not necessarily seeing that. The idea that this trauma is being passed down is intriguing and provides a much better answer than radiation from the incident, so I'm not trying to quell that discussion. I just disagree with assuming that Jacob is a source when you could just replace the man in black for Jacob in the argument it works much better. Batman, : I don't know. This might be why I have an obsession with beating up Martha. Best regards, Pat from Maryland. I love the idea of it like being Allison Janney's fault.
Sure.
Like her trauma radiating through the island. I also feel like
one thing working in the favor of Pat's argument here is, you know, specific to this episode, is that Jacob has a real aversion to getting involved with the humans, where it's sort of made clear to us that the man in black was sort of constantly screwing with the humans to try and disprove, you know, or just basically it's like Jacob's trying to conduct this experiment, and the variable is that like the man in black shows up and just creates havoc all the time with the humans that he's bringing to the island. So there, you could convince me that like it's part of like the man in black, you know, just trying to fuck with Jacob's whole, you know, long-term experiments in the nature of humanity, because he does seem to get directly involved, whereas Jacob needs a representative in Richard.
Yeah, I would almost say the reason, even though it could be the mother's echoing trauma, or it could be the man in black actively doing something like an extension of the sickness or like being claimed or something like that,
mm-hmm.
Jacob doesn't stop it. Like, he's the island god that could leave the island, that could touch people and make them immortal, that is master of this island that, like, heals all wounds. It feels like he's somewhat responsible if he wanted to be.
I have questions about the limits of Jacob's powers, right? Because we find that there are some things he has in common with Robin Williams' genie, as in, I can't bring people back from the dead, right? like he touches John. Maybe he needs a corpse to touch. I don't know. Anyway, he can't bring Isabella back. And then what actually really just burns my toast is that he can't, like, will no one please absolve poor Richard of the accidental murder of that asshole doctor?
It was literally, like, an accident.
Like, fuck that priest in the first place, but that's just, like, a corrupt priest. Okay. But Jacob can't absolve him of that? Like, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't he?
Yeah, Jacob doesn't care about human life.
No, I can't do that, but I can enslave you forever. What the fuck?
Right. For God that's still searching for the answers on whether or not humanity is good or bad, he's very, very inconsistent with when and where he does his judging.
Yeah, you know? And so it's like, he doesn't have the power to absolve, you know?
Or maybe it's just that, like, that's a thing Richard has to do for himself. Jacob's all about, like...
I wish he had said that, though.
He's like libertarian God. He's all about self.
I wish he had said something like, only you can, like, absolve yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Richard or something like that, and then we could have gotten the next line of, like, then I want to live forever because I'm petrified of hell. Like, okay, you know, you're not ready to absolve yourself, I'll give you mortality. I just, like, I can't do that. I'm sorry, Hal, I can't do that to fucking poor Richard, who's frantic and wet,
who you're trying to offer a job. Like, come on, build the man up a little bit.
Anyway, so does Jacob have the ability to stop this? I kind of like that it's this idea that, like, Claudia, or sorry, the mother, not, I get them confused, the mother dies, and her death means that, like, and then he's not powerful enough to stop it, sort of thing. Because there are limits to his power.
Well, also, I don't know. I could believe it's the mother if we also believe the sort of headcanon that the mother's been a smoke monster. Like, she's been exposed to the light, and that's how she's able to massacre the people who build the well. And so if that happens, and we successfully see the dagger used on a magical being, which would be the one time it is, then, yeah, maybe there is some sort of, like, psychic, you know, breaking. Sorry, second time we see the dagger used, because, no, Ben just uses a dagger. Not the dagger, correct?
Right, and this is something I didn't want to ask in the calm, but here in the storm, I'm more than comfortable. Is that dagger is, like, full of shit, right? That whole dagger thing?
I mean, it must be. I mean, if anything, it's like, if you saw, you know, if you killed your mom with a dagger, you would maybe put importance on that dagger. Mm-hmm. But, like, maybe when
the ultimate... the ultimate solution, right, to being able to kill the Men in Black is not the dagger. It's like they need to
pull out the cork and then make him mortal.
They need to pull out the cork and then shoot his ass. So at no point does the dagger actually come back and become important again.
If I'm gonna,
why do they do it twice? Why is it there?
This is on the list of, like, things that people were like, "This is mythology that you built up that you never really answered," right?
And leave it buried in Dogen's flower box. Right? Never just undig it.
Have it be a different knife. Every time, because it doesn't matter.
Or just don't do that thing where, like, if you let him speak, you've already lost, because it doesn't... Does that matter? I don't know.
Like, that seems like a game of telephone, right? So, okay. Man in Black kills his mom with the dagger. Keeps the dagger. That's his weapon he has on him. He's otherwise could turn into black smoke. Where I could guess he can't kill Jacob because of the rules. So he gives this other dude the dagger. He knows Jacob's going to tell him a different truth. So he says, don't let him speak, because then he's going to convince you. But then Richard, thinking he was handed a magic dagger and sent to kill an island god, somehow telephones this down through history as in, like, don't let him speak. But, like, really, it's like, you can't kill the smoke monster with the dagger.
And it makes, because we have to assume that at some point Richard and Dogen met, right? And coordinated.
Presumably.
So that's where Dogen gets the idea. So, yeah, I think it works better as a game of historical telephone than a real rule for the island.
Again, everything Dogen touches turns to shit. Just...
everything Dogen buries underneath his and poison plants.
Also, Alana, does she blow up in the next episode? Like, she blows up really soon.
Yeah, she blows up very soon.
Yeah, and so, like, the hospital stuff is like, why? Like, we know that, like, initially they thought Jacob was going to be her dad. Like, for real bio dad or whatever, however that works. But, like, since it's not, and since they know they're going to blow, presumably they know by Abaterna that they're going to blow her up in the next episode. Why?
Yeah.
Take me away from this hotel room, this hospital room. I don't want to.
I mean, I understand why they didn't, maybe why they didn't make Alana Jacob's, like, biological child, because that only moves me more onto the side of the man in black in this argument. So you're telling me that this guy is not allowed to leave the island, but Jacob is not only allowed to leave, but he can also, like, have kids and a family and, like, do normal human non-god stuff.
That the man in black wanted.
You're telling me and the man in black solution is because he doesn't want to make a dynasty of Jacobs?
Well, and I mean, I'm just saying that it brings more into focus the reasons why the man in black would want to fucking kill Jacob, right?
Yeah. Robbed of his body, robbed of his humanity. I'd be pissed too.
Yeah. Robbed of his ability to take vacations.
I still like the idea that, well, I think it came way back in one of our early storms. I forget, I'm sorry, which listener wrote it in, but that he's just humanity exposed to the light, but the man in black is actually just polluted light. Like, that makes so much more sense to me in terms of a mythological thing, because it's not Jacob's fighting with his brother. It's Jacob can't bring himself to, like, actually fight with something that's wearing his brother's face, whereas Jack is going to be able to, you know?
Hmm. Yeah. And he's going to be able to kill his old friend, John Locke.
That's right, because you're disrespecting John Locke's face. I think that conversation's coming up pretty soon, too, which is peak Jack and Smoke Monster, I think.
Well, except for when they're punching each other. That's pretty great.
I thought that was in the finale. Is it sooner than that?
Don't they run across each other before, like, after Desmond's on island?
Oh, I'm sure they run across each other. I just thought his whole, like, you're disrespecting John Locke's face thing comes in the finale. But I could be wrong.
Oh, maybe it is. I'm going off of, on the official podcast, as that if I would have played more of that clip, they're like, at some point, someone's going to sit down and ask the man in black these very questions, and he's going to answer them more than we are on this podcast. And that is Jack doing it. But again, they have just written the finale when they record this official podcast, so maybe it isn't the finale and it's not coming up. Mm-hmm. It's just something they know is happening.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't... I'm about to finish the back half of season 6, my, like, prep watch, but that does feel like a finale thing to me as well.
All right. Well, then, do we have more emails?
I don't think we need to. I think we're good.
We're going to roll some over. Well, guys, welcome, Stormies, into the Calm Cork era of Lost.
The Calm Cork era.
Just don't tell them it's a real cork yet. They're gonna get to figure that out.
Just let them discover that little trinket for themselves.
Don't tell them Hell's butt plug.
Hell's butt plug.
Hell's, like, in stone engraved butt plug.
It's a very ornate plug.
Oh, boy.
Made by who? Who knows? Made by when? Who cares?
It's definitely not Roman, though, like the dagger.
Correct. All right. So as we do that and march towards next week, where I think Desmond finally shows up. Neil, what's happening?
Actually,
what?
I do have a quick question for you because I doubt we'll have time for it.
Okay, yeah.
In the finale. This is just a me question. But maybe, I mean, like, maybe we want to ask. Okay, let's ask two questions. Number one, because I don't know that we'll remember to talk about it, but maybe we will. One of our listeners wrote in to ask who we think woke up Boone in the Flash sideways. That's to come, but Saeed wakes up Shannon.
Mm-hmm.
They wake up each other. But Boone is already woken up because he's, like, in cahoots. So, like, who woke Boone up?
Mm.
There's no one else who was, like, important to Boone.
Locke.
But Locke isn't awake yet. Like, Locke's in the hospital.
No. What if Boone woke up coming back from the airport after talking to Locke?
Oh, Boone woke so early.
Yeah, and did nothing about it.
Classic Boone.
He's been off having his own adventures.
Guys, I got
knowing
the
pens. That he's in the afterlife.
Classic. All right, and then so then my question is Richard related. So Richard leaves the island on the Ajira flight. Like, he's one of the few folks to make it on that flight off. And I think they, like, you know, they note that, like, his hair is turning gray or whatever. Mm-hmm. So what do you think, like, Richard's not in the Flash Sideways. He's not in the church at the end. So, like, what do you think Richard's post-island life is like? Does he, like, rapidly decay? Is he, like, dust by the time they make it to the mainland? Or does
he
like,
dies,
live?
And then Isabella's already there, so he goes straight to whatever his church is.
But, like, what does he do for, like...
Oh, no, I picture it more like Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade. Like, he touches down and just becomes a pile of dust.
He's dust.
And do you think, like, Richard's church, you know, because it's all about, like, the people in your church are people that went through this, like, specific experience time in your life. Did they have to, like, do some expansion of the church for how many people would be in Richard's church at the end?
Or maybe Richard's church is just, like, his neighbors in Tenerife.
Right. It's either just, like, him and his wife and that dude from the Black Rock, or it's, like, 3,000 people.
So many others.
It's every... It's all... It's, you know, Cindy, the kids, everybody.
Okay, here's my pitch for a Richard spinoff show.
Mm-hmm.
What Richard does is sort of like a, hi, my name is Earl. Like, Richard spends the next however many years of his life going around to families of people who were connected to people who went to the island and died and, like, making amends and, like, helping their
and, like,
lives somehow.
Does he explain to them what happened on the island?
He produces a file folder and he's like, hello, my name
he's got a list of 108
Richard.
Names.
You could call me Ricardus or Ricardo if you prefer, whatever you prefer. Yeah. And he goes through and he's, like, talking to the descendants of, you know, whomsoever died on the island.
Yeah, it'd be a good excuse to bring I guess he's Flash Sideways. It's like, you could bring young David back and explain.
No, but you could bring him David back Jack. As like he's like someone. I don't know. Anyway.
And
I
then
just want,
in an effort to get the attention of the Queen of the Damned, he becomes a rock star and we're all the way back to Lestat life.
Lestat. Wait. While I still have you on the line here, hold on. I'm going to text you guys something. It's a meme that I just texted Kristen a little while ago, but I just thought you guys might enjoy it.
Dave quickly mutes his phone. Otherwise, you just hear Grogu go,
Wait, what does that sound again?
Oh.
Anyway, that's for you guys.
He is ageless.
Oh, man.
Do you want to describe what you're looking at?
Yeah, so we're looking at a progression of Nestor Carbonell's face between the years 2003 and 2018, which, if you're not quick with math, is 15 years of this man's life. And he looks somehow younger at the end of it.
Yeah, it's
like
really...
16. I would say that, like, 2014, 2016, 20, it's like every couple of years. But these last couple are, like, the best ones. I don't know, 2011, that's pretty solid.
And we should point out that he was, like, 36 when this thing starts.
Wow.
So in 2003, he's 36.
So that really is the best idea for a Lost sequel.
Right?
Yeah, bring him back. He could do it.
We bring the timeless guy back because he still looks the same.
Okay, so have him bouncing around the mainland, like, making amends or whatever. But you could then flash back to whoever their relative was on the island and, like, what their island time
man.
Was like with Ricardus.
Oh, this
could
is
have some
good.
New characters.
This is good, but it doesn't meld with Lost 2 because Lost 2 needs to be a secret for a season before it reveals that it's Lost 2.
Lost. Maybe a mysterious man just visits these families and we only see the back of his head until it spins around to the front of him in the season finale. And it's Richard Albert Lost.
I'd be up for that.
Cool. All right. That's my pitch. Anyway, email us your pitches for Richard Spinoffs or anything else or what Mikhail might be doing there at hostsitstormpodcast.com. And Dave, I will let you now finish the show as you were trying to do it a little bit earlier.
Yes, I think we get to see Desmond next week. But Neil, where are we going?
Well, we're going to be opening The Package, which is a Jin and Sun episode. Speaking of Mikhail, guess who's back next week in The Package? That's the most exciting Mikhail. Part. It's Mikhail. We get a little more Kimi. We're going to have a good time.
Oh, he's coming back. All right.
It's Mikhail.
Until then, where can people find more of your work around the internet? Let's start this week with Joanna Robinson.
Oh, if you want to have me hear me have a lengthy conversation with Kate Herron, the series director of Loki, you can hear that over on the Still Watching podcast. You can also hear us discuss Brokeback Mountain on the Little Gold Men podcast, which I watched for the first time, I think probably since the theaters, and cried all the tears out of my face. So that is what we're doing over on the VF podcast. Or you can find me on VF.com, just, you know, generally being a writer, I suppose.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com. You can get me on Twitter at rejects. Have one perfect shot. You can get both myself and Dave drafting for Screen Drafts Legacy Sequels episode, which I believe is coming out sometime in the next couple of weeks. We recorded it. It was very fun, and I obviously won.
I'm not gonna doubt that. It's just how bitter I am that I let you get away with it. Because, like, that was my whole thing. It's like, don't let Neil win. And then you did it. You did it. All right. Yeah, my name is Abe Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter at DA7E. You could listen to me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, except I'm not on this current week when you get this podcast. And next week, everyone's taking a vacation except for me. So there isn't going to be a podcast, or Dave gets to do whatever podcast he wants. Really, it's how much they're going to allow me to do without kicking me off the podcast. But I will also be here every week as we near the very end to tell you, do not fall down.
All right, hang on to your butts. We are closing out with the Stormy Nestor stuff. Thanks again to him so much for popping up to talk to us about this show and for being so indulgent as I questioned him about the org chart and also pitched him our Richard Albert spinoff idea. All right, here we go. Here is Nestor in the storm. So something we try to do on this show is keep it sort of spoilers only up to the episode we're covering, because you've got a lot of new folks watching. But we do a section at the end where we're like, go away. We're going to talk about some spoilers like that. Right. I don't want to necessarily talk to you about the finale of Lost. We've litigated that back and forth. We're fans of it, but that's fine. But what I'm deeply curious about is what you think Richard did once he left the island. He gets on the plane, he gets off the island. There was a part of me, you know, you get to see he starts going gray, right?
And he starts going gray.
Yeah.
He definitely starts going gray, which wasn't hard to do.
well, one question we had was like, is he just a pile of ash by the time they get to the island? Like, how rapidly is he aging? What is Richard's post-island life like?
Well, in fact, Ian Cusick and I became really close friends. We didn't have a single scene to do on the show. And yet, you know, our kids were in the same school. You know, by virtue of that, we got to know each other. We were sort of not far. We didn't live too far from each other. So we would hang out off the set a lot. And we've maintained our friendship. I have with just about everyone in the cast, you know, that I got to know. And, but we would joke about that. Like when we wrapped, it's like, what would your character be doing? What would each one of our characters be doing, you know, off the island, you know? And I think I'd be in deep therapy. There's no question. What abilities did he really have other than sort of being a consigliere? You know, I mean, maybe he was a handyman. I don't know. I mean, he did come from Tenerife. He learned a few things. Maybe, I don't know if he worked as a handyman. I don't know, but I know that he would be in deep therapy for sure. But I did worry for Richard off the island. I now he's mortal and it's like, he doesn't have that anymore, the immortality. So it's like, you know, at least he had that. He's like, well, I can't die. So I can get away with murder.
Oh, okay. We had a pitch for a Richard-centric Lost spinoff. Would you like to hear it?
I want to hear that for sure.
Okay. We're forever thinking, you know, because they're always talking about rebooting Lost or restarting Lost or whatever. So we're always thinking about like, what could that look like? So here's my pitch. Because you, sir, do not age along with your character. We could
smoke and mirrors.
We could work the flashbacks if we needed to. I was like, what if Richard spends his off island time going around making amends to all the families who like lost someone on the island or something like that? Because it is kind of nasty that like Jacob brings his people to the island and they just sort of die in his grand sort of philosophical experiment of who's good, who's evil, etc. I was like, what if Richard decides to take that on, make amends, and then we could flash back to sort of like him, because you know, what I love about this episode is that we get this one like concentrated story of Richard, but yeah, there's so many options of seeing Richard's entire history on the island, right? Hundreds of years, or like, you know, at least over 100 years on the island. So I'm like, Richard goes around sort of like Michael Landis. What was that Michael Landis show where he's like an angel, Highway to Heaven or something?
Yeah.
Or like My Name is Earl or something like that. Like some sort of like a men's road show for Richard with like,
I love it, but this is not an episode. This is a spinoff.
This is a series.
It's a full-on series.
Yeah.
That's a long series that we can shoot in Oahu again. Yes. Yeah.
Move back to Hawaii. You
know? I twist my arm. I love it. Yeah. Those are many amends. I mean, Richard was responsible for, you could say Jacob, but I mean, Richard was absolutely executing Jacob's vision. And yes, he's got a lot of blood on his hands. He has to sort of, there's a lot of amends he has to make to many families, for sure.
And we're rooting for Richard. So we want him to like feel, you know, as part of his therapy, maybe is something he does, you know?
I love it. I love that you're rooting for Richard, because if you look back, I mean, he did some awful things.
Well, I was shocked. I was actually kind of shocked. I was reading an old Collider interview you gave, and you were describing the first episode where Richard shows up to recruit Juliet. And you said, and he killed her ex-husband. And I'm honest with you, I've watched this series so many times. It never occurred to me that Richard was responsible. I thought it was like the quote unquote island that ran that man over with a bus. Interpretation where it was in the script that Richard engineered that death.
Oh, absolutely. And but I love that you think it's the island. I do remember playing against that as much as I could, because I had to convince, I had to win Juliet over, you know, to recruit her. So I had to play against it, that it was truly, but no, I mean, it was a mean, you know, the ends justify the means, you know, and that was sort of the mentality for him, which is so sinister. Which is why I was surprised it brought him back. I was like, really? This guy back?
This guy?
This evil guy. But you know who, you know, you need evil, you need conflict. And yet that's what I loved about what Damon Carlton, you know, the writers created, is that you could hate this character at one moment and suddenly you're like, suddenly find yourself rooting for them, you know? And it's also this notion, I know they've talked about it as well so much, but this notion that no one's any one thing, you know, we're all capable of all of it, you know, and that's a huge theme in the show. And but having the audience vacillate, you know, on a particular character, whether they like him or hate him, was a great ride, you know, that they provided for the fans, you know, and for us.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about Richard, but even though like we know that he at least partially engineered the genocide of the Dharma Initiative, yeah, we're still kind of on his side. I don't know. Credit to you, I suppose. So there you go.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just passing it on. Richard's just a good liar. It's like, hey, you know, it's Jacob. You know, it's the island. I'm just here. You know.
We do joke about that all the time, that we want to see the island org chart, because it's a little confused. Richard's position is a little confusing because he's like the consigliere. Does he have the authority to make, you know, like where does he stand in terms of authority and that sort of stuff, you know?
Exactly. Well, certainly under Jacob, but you're absolutely right. So how much power does he have? You know, I think, you know, in rewatching Avatar, Jacob's sort of deal with him was, I want you to try and do something I don't want to do, which is facilitate them to take, you know, to choose well, you know? So I think he's trying to get people to choose well. But you're right. He's facilitating some horrible things too. It's horrible purge, you know, the Dharma Initiative. It's not good.
It's not great. Not great. No. But we love him anyway, Richard Alpert.